pocket of deprivation surrounded by immense wealth.
I'm Polly Weston, and in my new series, I'm exploring the legacy of those walls today.
People should know that this did happen.
The Shadow of the Cutslow Walls on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday at 1:45.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 29th of March. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. A number of people have been injured, some seriously, after a car ploughed into pedestrians in Derby city centre. The driver, a man in his 30s, has been arrested. Police say they don't believe there's an ongoing risk to the public. Lee Milner has been following the story.
What we know so far is that a black Suzuki Swift drove into multiple people. Now, some are believed to be seriously hurt. Many of them were treated at the side of the road before being taken to hospital. We've seen on social media many videos of people lying on the floor, people helping other people up while the ambulances and police officers help with the casualties.
Iranian-backed Houthi militias in Yemen have warned they'll keep targeting Israel in the coming days after launching their first attacks since the war in the Middle East began a month ago. The Houthis' decision to join the conflict has led to fears of further disruption to the world economy. Our correspondent Sebastian Usher is monitoring developments from Jerusalem.
Now in its second month, the war shows little sign of slackening on all fronts, including the new one opened by the Houthis in Yemen. The Iranian-backed movement has fired a second volley of missiles and drones at Israel. An even bigger concern about the group's belated entry into the conflict is that it might try to close off the key commercial waterway, the Bab al-Mandab Strait in the Red Sea, heaping further pain on the global economy. Iran has fired more missiles at its Gulf neighbours in the past few hours. It's also warned that it could target Israeli and American universities in the Middle East in response to an alleged strike on a university in Tehran. There are reports of two explosions in the Iranian capital this morning as the US-Israeli air offensive continues.
Iran has continued to target neighbouring Gulf countries, with the United Arab Emirates coming under particular fire. Qatar, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia have all reported attacks. And Alba, an aluminium smelter in Bahrain, says its facilities have been targeted and it's assessing the damage. The Conservatives are launching a Get Britain drilling campaign calling for the UK to maximise the use of its oil and gas reserves to bring energy bills down. The party leader, Kemi Badenoch, wants an end to the moratorium on new oil and gas licences and a scrapping of the windfall tax on energy profits. But the Energy Minister, Michael Shanks, said the Conservatives' own energy spokeswoman had admitted that new North Sea licences would not take a penny off bills. England's largest education union says large class sizes and a lack of staff are stopping teachers from properly supporting children with special educational needs and disabilities. The National Education Union says its teacher survey demonstrates mainstream schools are not properly resourced to cope with the demand. The government says it's investing £4 billion of extra funding over the next 3 years to improve SEND provision. The union's General Secretary, Daniel Kebbedee, says class sizes should be reduced.
We have a unique opportunity now to bring our class sizes down. At the moment, we've got some of the highest class sizes in the OECD, 1 million children being taught in class sizes of 31 or more. If we brought those class sizes down to a European average of around 20, you could cater for more children with additional needs in a mainstream setting.
Sir Keir Starmer has signalled the government is prepared to act to try to stop social media companies using addictive functions that keep young people hooked, saying such features shouldn't be permitted. In an interview with the Sunday Mirror, the Prime Minister said last week's US jury verdict against Meta and Google could mark a turning point, leading to much stricter content restriction. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
The government is currently holding a public consultation on whether to ban social media for the under-16s and other possible restrictions. But the direction of travel seems clear. While Sir Keir Starmer said he was open-minded about a ban, he said the next generation would not forgive the government if it did not act. Addictive features like infinite scrolling and autoplay could be in ministers' sights. Last week, Meta and Google were held liable in a landmark legal case in the US that found social media platforms were designed to be addictive to children, a decision Sakir described as a turning point. Both companies have said they will appeal. The Conservatives have said they would introduce an under-16 social media ban, while the Lib Dems said urgent action was needed to protect children.
A ferry that's crossed the River Mersey for 67 years is sailing for the final time. In her decades-long career, the Royal Iris has featured in films and the opening credits for the sitcom The Liverbirds, as well as carrying generations of passengers. The Royal Iris will be replaced by a new ferry later this year. And finally, a reminder that the clocks have gone forward an hour, marking the start of British summertime. BBC News.
Lisa Costello, many thanks indeed. This is BBC Radio 4. Heart and Soul is coming up shortly, hearing about one man's story of conversion. Then Marie Lennon goes to meet Jim Webster to understand what it means to live in rural poverty. That's in this morning's On Your Farm. It's in half an hour. Later, a report claiming the number of young people attending church in England and Wales had skyrocketed has been retracted after the data was found to be flawed. We look into that story and other ethical and religious issues of the week in Sunday at 7:10.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here.
Hi, Roger. It's Brian.
These are the voice notes of Brian and Roger.
I've had a word with Paul, and he's willing to accept the bet if you live in a bin for a week instead of me.
A dark comedy about friendship.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here. Yeah, I'll take some reading with me. I've got a sleeping bag. Yeah.
One of them is nice. One of them isn't.
Hello, Brian. Are you going to come down today? I could really do with some water and some fruit.
Brian and Roger, the cult hit comedy, comes to Radio 4 with 6 exclusive episodes starting Wednesday night at 11. All hear the best of box set now on BBC Sounds.
Now time for Heart and Soul. Emily Wither met Ismail Fenter, a former American Christian pastor, who says he fell for Rumi, converted to Islam, and moved from Los Angeles to Turkey's central Anatolia to live in Rumi's spiritual home.
The musicians are warming up their instruments.
They're gathering, and you can see Hakan is putting the pudra, the talcum powder, down on the area where they're turning, and it makes it easier to turn instead of just working on concrete. And these are some of the semazins coming here.
I'm Emily Wither, and for this edition of Heart and Soul on BBC Radio 4, I'm in Konya, in Turkey's central Anatolia region. I'm about to watch a group of semazan, or whirling dervishes, perform a sema ritual, a form of whirling meditation and prayer used by the Mevlevi order.
There's something special about being able to do sema in the shadow of Rumi's tomb, to be here with guests from around the world that have come here looking for love, looking for something.
He's just chasing away a cat that's gone on to the spot where the dervishes will be performing this evening.
Welcome. Which language do you speak?
English.
Oh, English. Welcome. Welcome.
Many people will think of the whirling dervishes as a performance,
yes.
And there are obviously people coming to watch tonight.
Yes.
But the dervishes are not whirling for us, they're not dancing for us.
No, we're not dancing at all, actually. We are doing sema, we are making sema. The dervishes start with their hands crossed over their chest, and then as the semazens ask permission to whirl, they begin to whirl, and then gradually, like a flower, open their arms up to the sky. And the symbolism is that from the right hand we receive from God, passes through the heart, and with the left hand we give to the world. So as they turn, they're giving blessings to everybody. And that's how I like to describe it, as blessings. Could be love, could be justice, all the things that God has to give. This is the journey our souls need to make to receive from Allah and to give to everybody. But what we tend to do is to take from Allah, demand from Allah, and keep to ourselves. And so that's why the journey of the dervish is so important, because it's about receiving and giving.
And I'm here to learn about Ismail Fenter's journey to becoming a whirling dervish. Raised in Los Angeles, he was once a Christian pastor before converting to Islam, changing his name from Craig and uprooting his life after falling in love with the teachings of Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, a 13th century Persian poet, Islamic scholar and Sufi mystic, whose writings on divine love and the soul's journey toward God has inspired people across faiths. They transformed Ismail's life. He moved to Konya permanently 4 years ago, the spiritual centre of Rumi's legacy and his final resting place. After Rumi's death in 1273, his followers founded the Mevlevi order, dedicated to his teachings. They're famous for these Sema ceremonies, where dervishes dressed in white robes and tall felt hats slowly spin in prayer, with their arms outstretched towards the sky.
It's not just when we open our arms, it's like a rose. No, it's like a bird flying. It's like an angel flying. Rumi tells us in his stories, he says, no, don't you know that you're like a falcon? You're like a falcon who sits on the arm of the Shah, you know, and you should be able to fly free, not living in the ruins. So yes, Sema is also like that. There are moments where you fly. It has moments where you can transcend. And you go up, and sometimes you stay up for a while, but then you come back down. But that moment you go up, you've gone to that place of no place, if that makes sense. And at the same time, you're aware because there are other people around you. You know there are people around you, and yet you're not there, and yet you are. So there is a mystical moment that can happen in making Sema. Sema is a hosh gelden is. So, my dear friends, guests, lovers of Hazrati Mevlana, welcome to our Sema and Aga Irani Ha Hamin Jos Hosh Amadid. On every turn, we are saying Allah's name. All you hear is Allah's name. What does the word Sema mean? To hear. It means to listen. In Judaism, it's Shema, same thing. Listen, Israel. Ha, Sema is the same word to listen, but what do you hear in Sema? In yourself, you hear Allah, Allah in yourself, but you also hear everybody around you saying Allah, Allah.
The dervishes are also wearing a tall hat. What does that symbolize?
The tall hat is called a sikke, S-I-K-K-E, which represents our gravestone. So it is about dying before you die. It is about the death of the ego, the death of the self. The Sufi word is called fana, which means to annihilate the ego.
What does it mean to be a dervish today? What practices do you think are essential?
To be a dervish today is different than it was in the past because we live normal lives today. The head of the Mevlevi order says it's important for us to be part of society, you know, to look like part of society so we don't wear special clothes around the street, you know, wear robes and things like that. We dress normally. So what's important is to have a daily practice of prayer, daily practice of what we have a book of daily recitations called Evrari Sherefe, the blessed words, if you will, simple translation, which is praise of to Allah, praise of the Prophet, sections from Quran, and then to be of service to your family, to yourself, and to the world.
Ismail stumbled across the writings of Rumi at a bookstore back home. He was at a point in his life where he'd walked away from his role as a university teacher and Christian minister, followed by a top job as a music producer in Hollywood. He felt a deep spiritual void and wasn't sure what came next. He was drawn to Rumi's work and later met S.N. Chelebi, Rumi's 22nd generation granddaughter, at an event in the US. It led him to Konya on a visit that would change his life.
Thank you.
We're just entering the most important and spiritual site for followers of Rumi, and tens of thousands of people make a pilgrimage here every year to visit his tomb, which sits in a grand mausoleum surrounded by rose gardens.
First time I visited Konya was in December of 2005. And one morning, we came over here super early in the morning, and we came into the courtyard here at Rumi's museum, and Faruk Hemdem Çelebi, the Makam Çelebi of the Mevlevi Order, the head of the Mevlevi Order, grabbed me. I mean, I just met him, and he took me by the arm and brought me around the back side of the museum, and I want to show that to you right now where that is. Let's open the gate for you. And this used to be what was called the Niyaz Penceresi, something like the window of desire or the window of intent. So he said, we come here to make our desires, our wishes known to God. And he was standing there praying, and there was snow on the ground, but I noticed over in the rose garden, there was a single rose popping through the snow, and it caught my eye. And so then I turned back to him, and he was finishing his prayers, and he came down the steps and said, okay, now it's your turn. And I was kind of stunned because I don't know what to do. I mean, first time here ever. So I slowly walked up the steps and stood in front of the window, and I didn't know what to say or do, so I just got quiet and stood still. Then all of a sudden I felt like, bam, like an arrow got shot into my heart. I don't know how to describe it. And I was kind of stunned, and I began to cry. And that was my first experience here. And I knew at that moment that I needed to be here. Everything that I had done in the past was like preparation for this moment and what was coming afterwards. And I said, I need to become a Mevlevi. And to be Mevlevi, to be a follower of Rumi, of Hazreti Mevlana, I need to become a Muslim. Because the Mevlevi order is an Islamic order. I said, fine, that's what I'm going to do. And then when I returned to America, alhamdulillah, I became a Muslim. I said, that's the way I need to go. So I truly understand his life. So I truly understand what he's teaching, because the Rumi quotes we see on the internet are all sugar-coated quotes about love and things like that, but he's so much more. And to do that, I needed to immerse myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I first discovered Rumi, is some of his love poetry. I mean, it's really beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is beautiful. I mean, yes, there are all of those lovely love poems and love quotes, but he writes about the battle of the Moses and Pharaoh inside ourselves. You want peace? You have to start with peace inside yourself. People don't want to hear that. Look in the mirror and change who you are. He actually says, don't change the histories. Change yourself. You can't have divine love until you actually go higher and higher. Most people think the love we experience down here at the lowest level is what love is. I had a teacher years ago say to me, the love that we experience in this life is like the millionth photocopy of an original photocopy. Divine love, the same kind of love that God shows us for other people, then you need to get rid of all of your desires, lust, anger, prejudice, all of those things, so that we can actually experience what the true love is. Otherwise you can't. There's a veil up from this world. It's just a veil.
That was how Rumi's teachings drew Ismail into Islam and the Mevlevi order. For others, his poetry is something they weave into their own existing faith or philosophy. But Ismail says moving to Konya and converting to Islam brought him spiritually closer to Rumi.
You know, you see it walking around the museum and seeing people from all over the world coming here and feeling this thing that he has, whatever that is, that still exists in this place. And to be able to come here any day that I want and to get near Rumi, get whatever is spilling out of him onto me, washing over me. People from all over the world do that. They come here wanting. They don't know what they're wanting. Maybe it's love, maybe it's healing. But they come, and even if they don't know why they're here, they're still getting that. So there's something special about this place. The entrance of the museum says, those who enter here leave complete.
Do you feel that as a foreigner you were accepted into the Mevlevi order, or was it difficult at first?
No, that's what's amazing. When I came here, I felt like I was home. I remember sitting in a restaurant, maybe my second trip here, my third trip here, and a young dervish looked at me and said, "Do you have any family?" And I said, "Well, my mother and father have passed away." And he looked at me and said, "Well, where are your family now?" And that's how I've always felt from the moment I got here.
You're listening to Heart and Soul on Radio 4 with me, Emily Wither. I've come to Konya in Turkey, a place of pilgrimage for followers of Jalaleddin Rumi, to meet a former Christian minister who left his life in the US to become a whirling dervish in the Mevlevi order, a Sufi Muslim brotherhood rooted in Rumi's teachings.
Would you like tea or coffee?
Yeah, I'd have tea.
How much of a role did faith play in your childhood?
My family, I would say we went to church every Sunday, and I was in religious parochial school every day. So I was memorizing the Old Testament, memorizing the New Testament, doing religious studies every day, singing in the choir, growing up in a church. So faith was always important to me.
So when you finished school and you went on to university, did you feel like your family had a path for you already?
So it was really my grandmother that wanted me to go into the ministry. I wanted to be a musician. I was, already knocking on doors and doing things musically. But it was grandma that really wanted me to go into the ministry. And so I went into the religious school system. But the more I studied, the more it was like I was questioning not what I believed, but it was questioning what the text was saying. Because I'm a critical scholar, and then I went to University of Michigan for a doctoral program with higher critical studies. And my research was also taking me to a path where, I'm not believing this New Testament stuff about Jesus. Not what he did, but about who they said he was. Because if you've read the Old Testament with critical eyes, you can't take it for granted what's being said in the Gospels and accept it blindly. You say, Matthew's doing one thing, Mark's doing something else, Luke's doing something else, John's doing something else, and they're not telling the same story, but they're all trying to prove a point, to prove what they believed. It's not what I was believing based on the research.
So you were on the path at that point in university to become a Lutheran minister. What happened?
Right, correct. So while I'm at seminary, the church was going through all these changes, and even they changed the language of the creed. They updated the creed. Instead of one holy Christian and apostolic church, it said one holy Catholic and apostolic church. And while I was at seminary, I also was serving as a campus minister at the Jesuit University in St. Louis. Well, if I'm in this world, maybe I need to be looking at being a Jesuit, because they were smart, they were intellectual, and maybe I need to be looking at that. While at the same time, on the other hand, doing my own research and going, I'm not sure I understand what this is all about, what the New Testament is writing when the Old Testament says something very clearly. There's only one God, right? Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Listen, Israel, there's only one God. Okay, I understand how the Trinity comes into manifestation. I understand logically how that works, but I had issues with that. It wasn't about faith. Again, it was about religion and where I fit into this spiritual path. After seminary, I remember having a conversation with the president of the seminary and saying, I can't do this.
For many Christians, the Trinity is central to their faith. But for Ismail, it became one of the reasons he started to look elsewhere. And eventually, he walked away from it all to pursue his long-held dream of working in music.
Look at you, the world I knew gets smaller, and the night just drifts away.
Wound up coming back to Los Angeles to do a doctoral program in music at the University of Southern California, working in Hollywood, and finding that I loved music, but I didn't like the people I was working with because they were all egotistical and all about themselves, and the music as joy was disappearing and was becoming work, and having to work with people that were just mean, self-centered people, Not everybody was that way. But if you're going to succeed in Hollywood, you have to have a lot of oftentimes misplaced ego. So it was in that journey I started to search, because I was feeling empty and I needed to find the path for me to go.
Dr. Shikile, we've got some tea arriving now. Were you happy in those years? Because you were finally doing what it was that you always wanted to do, which was music.
Yeah, I had happy moments. I was really happy, Tishakuradetis. I had happy moments. I had some really happy times. I had successful shows I was doing. I was musical director of the year one year in Los Angeles. I had lots of things doing music. But in the end, my spiritual side was drying up, and I didn't know what to do. All of the outside pressure was getting to me. And the reality is, I had a couple experiences where I was so disappointed in the person in front of me that I said, I just can't do this anymore. This is ridiculous. Where's my joy for music? Where's my love for music? And so I walked away from the music business.
Wow, that must have been a really big decision. Do you think you walked away from it because a big part of your spiritual life was just not there?
Yes, I think so. I think it's absolutely right. I was in that in-between spot that we often are in our lives, because I must have been 40-ish at that time, kind of like trying to figure out what the next thing was, since I walked away from A, I walked away from B, and so now what do I do?
Can you remember when the first time was that you discovered some of Rumi's work? Was it in this period or earlier?
Yeah, I'm sure it was in this period. It had to be. Some of you remember Borders bookstores. You know, I would sit in there and browse through the bookshelves, and I ran across this itty-bitty book by Coleman Barks called The Essential Rumi. And it had all these wonderful, for lack of better words, love quotes in it. Also with a language I didn't fully understand. Because now he's using images from Islam and the Middle East that I really didn't get. But I began looking and exploring, and that was probably the beginning of finding the food that I needed to find. Well, not probably, it was the beginning.
Why do you think his work resonated with you so much?
What I have come to believe over the years is that Rumi calls us. He calls us, and we don't even know we're being called sometimes. We don't know that we need to be called, but we hear something, you know. What does the Bible say, that still, subtle voice, that small voice talking inside us that kind of tickles us and says, come and learn a little bit more? And I think that's what was happening to me, because what it did, it opened up my traveling to learn and following people and searching deeper, like, who do I need to study with? Who is this person? Why are you here? Let me come find you and listen to you. Would have been really easy just to become a real arrogant, egotistical person to become successful in the music business. But what Rumi talks about is what we need to do is train our soul, train our ego, and so that it can raise itself up to a higher level, so that it can be, for lack of better words, purified, I say that in the best sense, from jealousy, anger, bias, prejudice, hatred, selfishness. Take your pick. All of those things that keep us from seeing who that person is in front of us, and ourselves for that matter. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma anta salam wa minka salam wa ilayka ya'udus salam.
I've returned to the Rumi Museum and Mausoleum with Ismail. The site dominates the skyline with a fluted dome of turquoise tiles.
I think it was in 2000, I had to do like 30 days of service as part of my becoming a Mevlevi dervish. And so I was working here in the museum every morning at 8 o'clock, mopping the floors, polishing things, doing things. And here in the museum, if you look, they have all the old candles that were oil-based candles.
Yes, so I can see hanging from the ceiling hundreds of these glass candle holders?
Candle holders, yes. Right.
Did you? Oh, don't tell me you had to dust every single one of these.
Every single one of these. Every single one. So on a ladder up there, dusting every single one out. And it was an amazing bit of service. But I also got to be able to be closer to everybody, being backstage here, so to speak. But it was an amazing time being here, getting to know the workers here who are and people who love to be of service here. Yes, that's their job, but it's really being of service.
We're here to take a look at Rumi's most famous work, the Masnavi, a vast series of spiritual poetry designed as a guide for the soul's journey toward unity with God. With the blessing of Rumi's descendants, Ismail is now translating it into English, creating what he calls a modern reader's guide for anyone who wants to really get inside Rumi's teachings. Every Friday at dawn, he shares that work with students from around the world in an online class.
We've been teaching the Masnavi here in Konya for 3 years online to an international audience. And we're just through the first book, and there's 6 books. So this is, you know, if God gives us permission to do this work, it's a 8, 9, 10 year project to get through it with a new translation, God willing, inshallah, we say, and to hopefully change the hearts and the lives of people that not only hear it, but to the people around them, that'll change their hearts and lives as well. It's amazing to be here.
What exactly are we looking at?
We're standing right now, of course, in front of Rumi's sanduka, in front of Rumi's coffin. But right here around the corner is the original Masnavi, the oldest manuscript of the Masnavi that exists.
These books are absolutely beautiful. They are painted very intricately. And
it's a beautiful book, and it's open to the first page, which is ornamented. The inside is not ornamented. It's columns of Persian text. And it's basically 25,000 verses of rhymed couplets. Masnavi is the name of the pattern of poetry. It's a rhymed poetry. What people don't know is that in that poetry, in the form itself, are embedded spiritual secrets. And if you try to translate it in poetry in English, you know, into Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill poetry, you lose all that meaning that's embedded in the poetry. And it's a manual for how to change ourselves so we can change our lives, so we can change the world. And so it's a huge responsibility to be able to interpret and read the Masnavi, because interpreting means interpret it correctly.
And I imagine the translations must be quite challenging at times. Do you get strength from coming here?
Yeah, I often, actually, when I come here, I stop at another grave over closer to the entrance of the... I actually come in here. One of the strange things, or I say strange, but humbling honors that I've been given. Recently, the head of the Mevlevi order, the Makam Chelebi, Faruk Hemdem Chelebi, gave me a destarli sikka, a sikka, the brown hat that's worn with a green turban around it, to be a Masnavi sheikh, to be, they call it Masnavi Han, a reader of the Masnavi. And the inspiration for the Masnavi is this person here, Chelebi Husamuddin. He and Rumi sat together for years, Rumi reciting and Chelebi Husamuddin recording, what Rumi was dictating, in a sense, going back, correcting it, fixing the grammar, and then reading it back to Hazrat Mevlana, to Rumi. He's, some say, the inspiration of the Masnavi, and so he's very important to me, even more so these days.
How do you feel when you come here?
Standing in front of Rumi, you know, who is what I consider to be my teacher. He is my real teacher. They say Murshid in Sufism. He's my leader, he's my guide. And so when I'm doing the translation of the Masnavi, it's as if he's talking to me. And then I share the teachings with my students. And this is where we are, standing in front of him. You can feel it in here. You can feel like the prayers of thousands and thousands of people. The energy in here is different than other places. It's a unique place. Thousands and thousands of people come here every year to visit this, and wanting to, as we were talking about, to find that love that he talks about. Some people are called and they don't know they're called, and they come here seeking. And some people come here and walk away wondering what happened. You know, they leave in wonder. They don't know why they were here. Maybe later they're touched by it, but you can see, even standing here at this time of the day, it's kind of quiet. But people from all different backgrounds, Turks, Americans, Europeans, Asians, Iranians, all kinds of people are here. People that are religious, people that aren't religious, they all come here because he was somebody special. He was very special.
Heart and Soul was produced and presented by Emily Wither. In just a moment, the farmer and the food bank is the topic of farming today. On your farm, rather, that's coming up in a moment. Let's look ahead to later this morning on this Palm Sunday. We visit the Fife Pilgrim Way. That's on Sunday worship at 8:10.
On BBC iPlayer.
What you see, you can't unsee.
Everything from nightmare fuel.
There's a beast on this island!
We've seen it!
We will have vengeance.
To nightmare remedies.
It's okay, I'm fine!
Don't laugh at me!
What's catch of the day? You are, Alan.
From chilling drama to laugh-out-loud comedy. Why ever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Now, On Your Farm, presented today by Marie Lennon.
Jim Webster is a man who really understands the value of food. Not only because he has spent his life producing it as a farmer, but also because he knows what it means to go without it. Alongside his career, he's been advocating for those in his community living in poverty. What's amazing is that there is shipbuilding going on a few miles down the road. If the weather's right, you can see the sea from here as well. The landscape is just very soft, isn't it? You've got these lovely, soft, green hills around you. Just pinpoint where we are in the country and what's around us.
We're at the bottom end of Cumbria, the Furness Peninsula, which it's the bit that hangs down opposite the Alaman. When you look at the map, move north to the Alaman, turn right and you've hit us.
And you're very proud of it.
We always say when you drive along the coast road that England's cut off because you can't see it. I don't know how they manage without us, but...
You're in your own world here, aren't you, really?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we're the bottom end of Cumbria. We're not the Lake District. We're not a tourist area, really. We're actually an industrial area. Yeah, I mean, Barrafolk are OK. I always tell people, I run the bovine equivalent of a combination of St. Trinian's and a Swiss finishing school. And this is the St. Trinian's end.
Is it?
The Ooh. Swiss finishing school is up there.
OK, well, I look forward to that. Do they know you feel this way about them?
I think that's an improvement on my normal comments.
So, Jim, what's going on?
I'm just cleaning these out. I'm about to bed them. Well, I'm about to bed the other ones. And then they will get their breakfast and happiness will ensue.
Every day? This is you every morning?
Every morning. 7 mornings a week. Well, until they turn out. So, like everybody else, I'm looking forward to grass day.
How long have you been here farming at this place? You were born here?
Yeah. 1956. My grandfather bought it in, I think, about 23, 24. We've just clocked up over a century.
How do you feel about this landscape that you farm in?
Given my family built it, I can hardly complain. I mean, you look at the hedges around.
Yeah.
I mean, that one my grandfather should have cracked on with, to be honest. But, but yeah, when I say we built it, certainly we've kept it going.
And you've shaped it.
I've shaped it.
How old are these sheds then?
Old enough for the tins to rot.
The tins are rotting a bit. Well, you know, the Cumbrian weather doesn't help, does it?
We were concreting that floor the day that Charles and Diana got married.
That's how you spent that day.
My father used to say, what was it? He'd been spared a lot of grief through hard work and poverty. From the age of Well, I was old enough to drive a tractor. I was taking calves and selling them in Ulverston.
And has it always been cattle? You're a cattle person, aren't you?
I am a cowman. I mean, we used to milk until the milk price dropped to 14 pence a litre and it got silly. I went across to Sucklers and then I did calf rearing. During foot and mouth, we were rearing calves and selling stores.
You've stuck on, you've done different things, but you're here and this is this isn't going to change, is it?
It'll drift, but yeah. So every year it's constant. This needs fixing, how can we do it better? All done as cheaply as possible.
Tell me a bit about the herds that you've got here. Where have they come from and why this lot?
We've got somebody's replacement dairy heifers. As you can see, they're a mixture of breeds, Montbéliard, Jerseyans, Frisians, and we just rear them.
Just bring them on?
Just bring them on. Keep them growing, get them in calf, send them back. I think there's just over 100 head of cattle on at the moment.
And does that work? The numbers work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You don't miss any of the other stuff? You don't miss the milking or the calving or any of that stuff?
I was lucky. I got out of dairying before milking knackered my knees.
Really?
Yeah, well, it went down to 14 pence then. Right. And at that point, we thought there was no point.
That period seems to be, it was quite important for you. A tough time,
well,
right?
When you go out of dairy, how do you put it? I know 1 month afterwards, our sole income was compensation paid to us by BT for not fixing the telephone on time.
No, really?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I did one time work out I was working for 9 pence an hour. So when that got out, somebody offered me 10. That's just agriculture for you. We had 3 years where we had a negative income, which was interesting.
What was that like day to day?
You just get in a habit of not spending money. And hope the overdraft doesn't rise too much at the end of the year. But waiting to have calves to sell and that sort of thing. Anyway, just before foot and mouth, we moved into buying calves and selling stores, which works better down here than Lowland Sucklers.
But you had a family to bring up, right?
Yes.
So how did you manage?
I've got a wife who's really good at that sort of thing. We just got by. Oh, yeah.
Every penny you've had to watch really carefully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man, for a snappy dresser like me, it comes hard.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Just after foot and mouth, I was asked by the CLA if I'd be their National Livestock Advisor. Well, I tell you, regular income. Good grief. So I did that as a freelance for 10 years.
And isn't that interesting that you made more from doing that, advising on keeping stock, than you did from actually keeping stock?
You go to any meeting where you have a bunch of Muppets on the stage telling farmers what to do and how to run their business, the Muppets on the stage will be on better money than the farmers are advising.
Right. That's it. Go on, Bill.
Everyone fed?
Everyone fed. Right.
Well done. Right, Jim, you've done your morning jobs.
Yeah.
And we've left the farm and we've just come a few miles into Barrow. Tell me where we are and what's going on.
We're just outside the Baptist Church in Barrow. Below the Baptist Church is the food bank. We partner with all the churches in Barrow, but the Baptist Church have been very generous with letting us have the premises.
It's not lost on me at all that you've spent your morning looking after cattle, which will end up being food, providing food. And here we are at a place which is also actively, every day, providing food.
But at least I don't have to shovel this one.
It's cleaner.
A lot cleaner.
We talked before about your experience of essentially running a business that was losing money for 3 years straight.
Oh, yeah.
And having no income coming in and having to keep finding a way to get through whilst also looking after kids and trying to pay the bills and put food on the table. Was it that experience that informed you starting to work in the charitable sector and to start actually being more of an activist?
It helped. When they founded the food bank, I turned up at the first meeting. I thought it's an excellent idea. There was a lot of good volunteers there. I thought, crack on, people. And I went back to agriculture and I applauded generally from the sidelines. Anyway, a few years later, I got a phone call from the rural dean. Jim, would you be a trustee, please? We're short of trustees. Go on, do me a bit. I walked in. The chairman said, this is Jim. He's a new trustee and a new chairman. And with that, he walked out. With the CLA, that brought me into contact with it because I was dealing with all sorts of people, but a lot of people who were the type of peasant farmer that I am. I was used to dealing with people who are on the financial margins. With Action with Communities in Cumbria, it's not just farming, but it is rural, and it's the same world. I got called in to help as a volunteer caseworker with FCN, which, again, is the same sort of thing.
We should just explain the acronym. So FCN, Farming Community Network, and yeah. CLA, Country, Land and Business Association.
The food bank happened by accident, but it fits in because it's just the same thing.
All right, let's go in. Oh, yeah, there's your food bank sign. We're going to go on into the basement, see what's going on. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Morning.
Morning.
This is like a rabbit warren. Yeah. If you've come in, and this is the basement of the Baptist Church, and you go in.
This is our warehouse.
It's like an underground warehouse, and there are rows and rows and rows of shelving. I mean, it's dizzying, and you've got these blue and green crates packed full of, well, I'll just have a look. I mean, there's dog food there.
Yeah.
We've got juice and milk, cereal, meat, tins. I mean, a dizzying number of tins.
It has to be tins, because we can't cope with fresh food.
No, of course not.
Pasta sauce.
Pasta sauce.
Oh, all right.
Hello.
Hello.
I've just come for a look around with Jim.
All right.
You're Anne?
Yes.
And you're Amy?
Yeah.
What are you doing? What's the plan of it?
Well, we're making up crates that will go out to the people who come and call for them. They have to bring a bag and then they can look through the various things that are in their crate. If there's something they really don't like, or if they're vegetarian and so they don't want the meat, then it can be swapped round. And they come in various sizes, for one person, two persons, 3 to 4, 5 to 6, and that's what we're doing.
And people with families, kids, dogs even, perhaps,
everything dog food, fits. Cat food. Yeah. Nappies, toiletries as well, you know, they have them as added on as extras when they call in.
We're walking around, in every corner of this church there are volunteers working, constructing tables for a bring and buy in one hall, topping up milk jugs for teas and coffees in the other. The corridors smell of the hot pies that are being cooked for the free lunch that's about to start. And Jim walks through, catching up with volunteers, checking up on one visitor's wait for a neop, all while food parcels are being packed in the basement, ready for anybody who walks in. This feels like I'm going into a cafe. You've got tables with tablecloths. You've got lollies for the kids. So this is the drop-in.
Yeah.
This is the drop-in.
Yeah, and this is the idea that it is somewhere nice, because we do three things. One is we feed people. Yeah. One is we try and find out what the problem is and help them with the problems. But the third thing, and the most important, is we treat people as human beings, and that's not something that's all that common nowadays. Yeah. Yeah, that is the idea, that it's a nice place to be. Yeah. I think we've got customers.
The food bank got here on Friday, but it's just like that.
My name's Matthew Burden, and I'm the project manager of Barrow Food Bank.
What's it like at the moment?
It's busy. It's busy in the sense there's a lot of people needing to use the food bank. A lot of people are in work needing to use the food bank. A lot of people where households with two people in work need to use the food bank. We're doing okay for donations, but we're not receiving the same amount of donations as we have done in the past, both in terms of food and in terms of money as well. So they've sort of decreased. And what we can buy with the money that people donate is less, as prices have sort of skyrocketed over the past couple of years.
Which is what people are seeing and feeling, right? Your money's not going as far. And I suppose what that means is that for donations, the people that might have had a bit extra, they could have chucked a bit in, can't do that anymore.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And if someone in the past had donated £10, then we could have gone out and bought probably, I don't know, 12 tins of soup. And now we maybe get 3 or 4 tins of soup for the same sort of price. So.
Who's coming to you? Where are they from? Why do they need you?
They're primarily from the wards in Barrow that are some of the most deprived wards in the country. They're needing to use us because they cannot make their money stretch far enough to buy the food that they need or to pay the bills that they've got. They're needing to use us because benefits have not kept pace with prices, wages have not kept pace with prices, mortgages have skyrocketed, all the things that we're all facing, really, that just things are just much more expensive than they used to be.
Across the country, the number of parcels that are being given out through Trussell Trust food banks is actually decreasing gradually, apart from the Northwest, where there is still a year-on-year increase.
Oh, I can see it. I can track on our data system how many parcels have gone out this year compared to previous years. And although we're not yet at the end of this current financial year, by the time we get to it, we will have increased what we did from last year, which would have been an increase from the year before. So, yeah, it's definitely going up.
I mean, we've just been on the farm talking a bit about, or seeing for real life, how food is produced and about how it fits into the landscape. Mm. And you see here people that cannot get access to good, nutritious food. Mm. I mean, what do you think needs to happen?
So, as well as the parcels that we give out to people, which you can see sort of behind you there, we also give them vouchers to use in local shops. So there's a butcher's, there's a greengrocer's, and then a sort of what you might describe as a world food shop. So people are getting access to fresh food that way. So we are also involved with a project in Ulverston, the Ulverston Food Project, and that is about stopping fresh food going into landfill and instead being distributed to people who are perhaps in food poverty to begin with, and then whatever's left over can go to people who perhaps could afford it but would rather take this stuff or buy this stuff rather than see it being wasted. So there's an attempt there to fitting in with kind of maybe what you were talking about before about rural poverty and attempting to get fresh food or healthier food to people that way and saving it from being, you know, just wasted as well.
It just strikes me that you've got people that are living really close to farmland. They're living on the doorstep of where food is being produced. People producing that food aren't making a good enough income. No. People living next door can't afford to buy the food anyway.
Absolutely.
So something's gone wrong, hasn't it?
Yeah. Just the idea that, yeah, farmers can't make a living because we're not paying them enough for the food they're producing, and perhaps we're over-reliant on food from other countries that's cheaper, but the air miles involved in it, you know, are not good at all. I don't know what the answer to that is.
No, you're feeding people in the meantime, that's the thing.
Yeah, sure.
So we have had a look in the bowels of the church, packed to the rafters, although not as packed as you'd like it to be with food.
I could stand another 20 ton in there, to be honest. If there's anybody volunteering, we can stand another 20 ton.
I can't get away from this thought that you have been a farmer not making money, and you probably know some farmers that are on very, very low incomes, if anything.
I know people who are going bust at this minute. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are.
For what reason? What's driving that?
Some of it's pure bad luck. They got caught with debt when interest prices went up. Some of it has been ill health because they haven't been able to cope. Some of it is just wild chance.
You use a phrase, peasant farmer, and you describe yourself as a peasant farmer. What do you mean by that?
Basically, it's those of us who were, it's very much a one-man band. You're marginal at the best of times. If people want to buy cheap crap from abroad, fine, but don't expect us to produce food at high standard in this country when it's standard you're not actually prepared to pay for.
And yet the stuff that we are importing, for some people, is still too much money because people can't afford it. And you can see that here.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
What's the answer?
Well, it's looking at the bigger picture. How much are people worth? Trouble is, it's now got to the stage that we're a low-wage economy. We're not a poor country, but we're a country with a lot of poor people.
You, I think more than most people, have got a real sense of what rural poverty looks like and feels like and how it's different to poverty elsewhere.
Even the metrics for measuring poverty don't work in rural areas because, for example, if you're down as a two-car family, then you're rich. No, you're a rural family struggling to get by. Neither car is worth anything. You need them, because if you have a job in a rural area, you can't wait for the bus. Most of mine that I do to support farmers is actually rescuing them from bureaucracy. I'm apparently one of the few people who can get farmers to talk to their GPs. I then try and find a tactful way of saying, have you talked to your doctor about your depression? I've been helping one person who's dealing with the animal health. I'm dealing with one person who's dealing with the environment agency. It's trying to educate them as well as trying to help the farmer.
It sounds like you, for a long time and still, are trying to be that middle ground as someone who understands some of the really complicated, detailed bureaucratic systems that oversee agriculture, but you also understand the reality of the precariousness of that farm income.
The phrase I always like is, the Lord tempers the wind to the shorn lamb. We stand there, we try and protect people, sometimes from the consequences of their own incomprehension, sometimes because it's the old saying, shit happens. It's just wandering in and just finding out what's going on.
The government are consulting on farm incomes and profitability. Is it the future that actually small holdings like you have, and that many of your neighbouring farms and people that you know have, they're just not sustainable because the money's not there? That just can't carry on.
Well, a lot of them, even in the last 30, 40 years, have been marginal and have survived because the wife went out to work. That's often fed people. Say you have five farms in a valley. You might have 10 children in the village school, people part at the church, people at the village hall. It's the difference between the community being viable and not.
And now we're back on the farm. I know what you do, both with the farm here that's been in your family all of your life, and then the work that you're doing in the charitable sector. But why? What's really driving it? What motivates you?
I probably have a low tolerance of boredom, to be honest. Somebody also said it's Jim. He's a maverick. He causes trouble wherever he goes.
Is that what you're doing? You're just causing a bit of trouble?
Probably. But I feel it's in a good cause. And it would not do for too many people to be smug and complacent, would it? It needs doing. Somebody has to do it. Why not me?
And it increasingly needs doing. But I guess it's one of those things that once you see the need, it's quite hard to walk away from it.
That's the problem. And, I mean, I'm from round here. These are my people. Yeah, I mean, I went to school in town. I was brought up with the people there. Most of my mates, their fathers worked in a shipyard. This is where I'm from. It's community. You build community. Someone once told me, community is like a marriage. You've got to keep working at it. Well, somebody has to.
On Your Farm was presented and produced by Marie Lennon, and it was a BBC Audio Bristol production. Let's get a weather update now. Let's say good morning to Sarah Keith Lucas.
Good morning, Neil. Well, the sun has risen now on the first day of British summertime, but the weather is looking particularly unsettled. Another windy day ahead today, feeling quite chilly, and rain in the north will push south, and it'll be followed by sunny spells and heavy showers. So for Scotland and Northern Ireland, we've got the rain sitting across the region this morning. It's quite heavy and persistent. There's a little bit of snow over the highest ground of Scotland too, and it's also windy. As we head through the morning, though, the band of cloud and rain will sink south, and it'll be followed by sunnier skies developing into the afternoon. But still some heavy showers as well, and they'll mainly be across central parts of Scotland, again falling as snow. Temperatures around about 7 to 10 for Scotland, perhaps as high as 12 or 13 for Northern Ireland later on, but the strength of the wind will be very noticeable, so it'll take the edge off those temperatures, and we could see gusts of 50, even 60 miles an hour in the north. For Northern England, into the Midlands, Wales and South West England, a dry, chilly start to the day, quite cloudy. The cloud will continue to thicken and we'll see rain moving gradually north to south across the region. It'll become lighter and more patchy in nature as it reaches the Midlands and parts of South West England by the afternoon, but it will be persistent for a time for Northern England and for Wales, and we'll see some sunshine returning from the north by the end of the day. Top temperatures here around 9 to 12, but again, it will be windy. Lastly, South East England and Eastern England. Well, here, chilly starts the morning. Clear skies, though. We've got some beautiful sunshine around. It'll be quite hazy in nature. The cloud will build through the afternoon and there'll be some patchy rain arriving by the evening. Temperatures around 10 or 11. And then through tonight, the cloud and rain clears away from southern England. So clear skies and some heavy showers continue in the north. Again, some hill snow for Scotland. But overnight lows between about 2 to 5 degrees. Into tomorrow, there'll be more sunshine than we've got today. Still a few blustery showers, particularly in the north, but the winds will ease and temperatures will be around 9 to 12 Celsius.
Scam Secrets is back for a new series.
The manipulation starts very subliminally.
I'm Shari Vahl. I investigate fraud for the BBC. Each week, I dissect the techniques criminals use to steal your money.
Hey, sweetie, I missed you a lot.
We associate so much fraud with the male voice, but the female voice we trust for various psychological reasons.
Please call me.
From romance and investment scams to one targeting online holiday bookings.
It was actually over 1,800 euros.
Exposing the fraudster's tactics to help keep you safe. Scam Secrets starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Thursday lunchtime. At 12.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 29th of March. Good morning, this is Lisa Costello. A number of people have been injured, some seriously, after a car hit pedestrians in the centre of Derby. Iran has again been launching missiles at Gulf neighbours, targeting their infrastructure. Teachers have warned that schools in England do not have enough staff to properly support children with special educational needs. A number of people have been injured, some seriously, after a car struck pedestrians in Derby city centre. The driver has been arrested. Lee Milner has the latest.
The incident happened at 9:30 last night on Friar Gate. It's one of the main historic streets in Derby city centre and would have been busy with people and traffic. It's understood a black Suzuki Swift car struck multiple pedestrians. Some are believed to be seriously hurt. Many were treated at the scene before being taken to hospital. In a statement, police said there wasn't an ongoing risk to the public, but Friar Gate is currently closed and drivers are being told to avoid the area. A man in his 30s has been arrested and is in custody. Officers say they're still in the early stages of their investigation and the motive behind the incident is unclear. They're asking anyone who saw the car to come forward. The Labour MP for Derby North, Catherine Atkinson, said on social media this morning that she was deeply shocked and her thoughts were with those who'd been injured.
Iranian-backed Houthi militias in Yemen have warned they'll keep targeting Israel in the coming days after launching their first attacks since the war in the Middle East began a month ago. The Houthis said they had fired two waves of missiles and drones yesterday. The Houthis' decision to join the conflict has led to fears of further disruption to the world economy. Iran has been firing more missiles at countries across the Gulf region, especially targeting infrastructure. Our correspondent Azadeh Mashiri is monitoring developments from Dubai.
The last 24 hours have seen the region face repeated attacks, including on major infrastructure. Yesterday, the United Arab Emirates saw the highest number of ballistic missile attacks in weeks. Emirates Global Aluminium says its major plant in Abu Dhabi was hit and significantly damaged, with several employees injured. Aluminium Bahrain, one of the world's largest aluminium producers, was also attacked. In Kuwait, the radar system at the international airport has been extensively damaged. With their economies and way of life on the line, countries in the Gulf insist they must have a say in any future peace talks. But they're split on the way forward and on what the region's relationship with Iran or the United States should look like.
The Conservatives are launching a Get Britain Drilling campaign, calling for the UK to maximise the use of its oil and gas reserves to bring energy bills down. The party leader, Kemi Badenoch, wants an end to the moratorium on new oil and gas licences and a scrapping of the windfall tax on energy profits. But the Energy Minister, Michael Shanks, said the Conservatives' own energy spokeswoman had admitted that new North Sea licences would not take a penny off bills. England's largest education union says large class sizes and a lack of staff are stopping teachers from properly supporting children with special educational needs and disabilities. The National Education Union says its teacher survey demonstrates mainstream schools are not properly resourced to cope with the demand for SEND support. Here's our education reporter, Hayley Clark.
A snapshot survey of more than 10,000 teachers and almost 3,000 support staff carried out by the NEU suggests they have several concerns around how the government's plans to make mainstream schools more inclusive can work. Their worries included the extra workload involved and large class sizes. The teachers questioned said a barrier to the successful inclusion of more children with special educational needs was not having enough support staff. The government says £4 billion of extra funding over the next 3 years will improve teacher and support staff training on SEND, as well as creating easy access to SEND specialists. But the union says this funding is not high enough to achieve the government's aims. It's calling for school spending to be increased to 5% of GDP, in line with the OECD average, and back to previous levels in England.
Sir Keir Starmer has signalled the government is prepared to act to try to stop social media companies using addictive functions that keep young people hooked, saying such features shouldn't be permitted. In an interview with the Sunday Mirror, the Prime Minister said last week's US jury verdict against Meta and Google could mark a turning point leading to much stricter content restriction. Here's our political correspondent Ben Wright.
The government is currently holding a public consultation on whether to ban social media for the under-16s and other possible restrictions. But the direction of travel seems clear. While Sir Keir Starmer said he was open-minded about a ban, he said the next generation would not forgive the government if it did not act. Addictive features like infinite scrolling and autoplay could be in ministers' sights. Last week, Meta and Google were held liable in a landmark legal case in the US that found social media platforms were designed to be addictive to children, a decision Sir Keir described as a turning point. Both companies have said they will appeal. The Conservatives have said they would introduce an under-16 social media ban, while the Lib Dems said urgent action was needed to protect children.
A ferry that's crossed the River Mersey for 67 years will sail for the final time today. In her decades-long career, the Royal Iris of the Mersey has played host to famous bands, royalty, and carried generations of passengers, as Lydia Dowling-Ranera reports.
People have been travelling by boat on the River Mersey for hundreds of years, with the earliest crossings organised by Benedictine monks in 1150 AD. The Royal Iris launched in 1959 and 5 years later was featured in the film Ferry Cross the Mersey, where Gerry and the Pacemakers sang their famous song.
So ferry, cross the Mersey.
The Beatles performed on the ferry in the early 1960s, and the late Queen Elizabeth II was welcomed aboard in 1977. The Royal Iris also featured in the opening credits of the sitcom The Liverbirds, and even played a part in the 2012 Olympic torch relay. Mersey Ferries say she'll be replaced by the new Royal Daffodil later this year, continuing an 800-year-old tradition.
And a reminder that the clocks have gone forward an hour, marking the start of British summertime. Time for a look at this morning's papers and the news that a man has been arrested after several people were struck by a car in Derby city centre came too late for the papers but is reflected on their websites. The Telegraph quotes one witness who said it was absolute carnage, adding that there were people lying in the road and on the pavement. Another person described the scene as utterly horrific. Reporters for Derbyshire Live at the site said an eerie stillness then took over as people tried to come to terms with what had happened. According to the Sunday Times, Britain is preparing to deploy a Royal Navy ship retrofitted with mine-hunting drones to the Strait of Hormuz. It's understood the vessel would, in effect, act as what the paper calls a mothership for equipment, housing specialist technology that could scan the seabed for threats, disarm mines and survey surrounding waters. The paper quotes a defence source as saying that a decision is still to be made on whether the vessel will be sent, but it gives ministers options. The front page of the Mail on Sunday says as many as 70 people from Britain have been arrested in the United Arab Emirates for taking what it calls war photos. The paper claims that some are being deprived of sleep, food and medicine after taking pictures of Iranian drone and missile attacks. There's a report in the Sunday Times that Royal Mail would like to remove a cap that limits annual increases to the price of a second-class stamp. The safeguard, which has been in place since the company was privatised more than a decade ago, has meant the price of a second-class stamp has only risen from 50 pence to 91 pence. No such cap exists on the price of a first-class stamp, which has sharply increased from 60 pence to £1.80 from next month. The Sunday Telegraph reports that Sir Keir Starmer's former Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney has been told to hand over any relevant messages from his personal mobile phone relating to Lord Mandelson. The request comes as the government deals with a promise to release communications regarding the peer's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. Mr McSweeney's government phone was stolen last year. The Sunday Times reports that Prince Harry is hopeful the King will invite him, as well as his wife and two young children, to spend some family time in Norfolk this summer. A friend of the Prince says this would ensure security was in place for the family while in Britain, a service that's under review due to Prince Harry and Meghan stepping back as working royals in 2020. The actor and comedian Miranda Hart is being touted as a replacement for Claudia Winkleman on Strictly Come Dancing, according to The Sun on Sunday. The paper says she's held secret talks with the BBC about joining the programme, with sources telling the paper her sense of humour would make her a perfect fit. And that's the news and papers this Sunday morning.
Many thanks, Lisa Costello. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 10 past 7. Time now for Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. This is what we have for you on this Palm Sunday. The Bible Society does a U-turn on its claims of a revival of Christianity in the UK.
The Quiet Revival was saying in particular younger people were going to church. There was a revival of spirituality. But so far, at least, the evidence doesn't suggest that there is any marked revival.
The Bible Society's chief executive will be here to explain what went wrong. We also report on a scam targeting British Muslims who just wanted to experience the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca.
Each one of those victims, each one of those pounds is someone or money that's been saved to try to go on the pilgrimage, the journey of a lifetime. And so the impact of each and every one of those numbers is huge.
And we talked to the Catholic composer Sir James McMillan about his new oratorio, which has just had its world premiere in the Sistine Chapel. Your emails to sunday@bbc.co.uk. On Wednesday, Dame Sarah Mullally was installed as the 106th Archbishop of Canterbury. It's an historic first for women in the church, but it comes at a very turbulent time for the Church of England, which has been struggling with safeguarding scandals and widening fractures in the Anglican Communion. The new Archbishop won't even be recognised as a priest by some churches in the Communion, who maintain that the Bible requires a male-only leadership. So what difference could a woman, as the spiritual leader of the Church and the Communion, make? And what unique skills and priorities will she bring to this new role? The BBC journalist Catherine Wyatt was in Canterbury for Sarah Mullally's installation and joins us now. Catherine, good morning. What stood out for you from Wednesday's ceremony?
I think for me, the ceremony was at once very traditional, but also incorporated new elements that spoke to Dame Sarah as a person. So, for example, she knocked on the cathedral's west door three times with her staff seeking entry, as is tradition. And she was installed on the chair of St. Augustine, upon which archbishops have been installed for centuries. But there were also individual touches which reflected Mullally herself. For example, instead of the traditional clasp, which holds together a bishop's robes, she wore a silver buckle made from her nurse's belt that she wore when she worked in the NHS.
That's a very nice touch, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What about the entree that every archbishop faces? What's in Sarah Mullally's?
Well, like you mentioned earlier, safeguarding, I think, will be at the top of her in-tray. Survivor advocates have long complained that the processes by which the church deals with complaints is both inadequate and not sufficiently independent. The church is set to introduce independent safeguarding officers as a way to improve. But last year, the Charity Commission said it was taking too long to do this and that it needed to work faster. Mullally will also have to deal with the church still divided on the issue of same-sex unions. Earlier this year, Synod, which is the church's national assembly, formally abandoned plans to hold blessing ceremonies for same-sex couples, which caused a lot of anger and upset, not least because it had previously voted in favour of finding a way to make that work. And of course, again, like you said, there are some in the church at home and in the Anglican communion abroad who do not think that she should be in the job at all because she's a woman. In response, she said she's always tried to be hospitable and open to those with different opinions.
Yet more evidence this is a multifaceted role, a bit of a pastor, a bit of a diplomat, sometimes even an umpire, Catherine. It was announced on Friday that she will be visiting West Africa in July. How significant could that be, that particular trip?
I think it will be very important. Dame Sarah is not just the leader of the church in England, like we said, but she's the spiritual leader of the Anglican Communion, which is made up of around 95 million Anglicans around the world. I think on the trip, she's going to visit Ghana and Cameroon, and it's a sign of how important that role is to her, especially because earlier this month, GAFCON, which is a group of conservative Anglican churches, they met in Nigeria. And they set up a new leadership council, and they oppose the fact, as we've spoken about, they oppose the fact that she's a woman. And so visiting Africa and bringing attention to the Anglicans that do support her is an important message for her to convey and a way of moving attention there, I think.
It was interesting to see the letters exchanged between the new Archbishop and the Pope, Pope Leo. Very warm greetings, in fact, from the Pope.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the split between the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church was a long time ago, and there's long been a friendship between the two. I liked in the ceremony the new Archbishop of Westminster, Richard Moth, that's the head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, gave a reading at Mullally's installation, and he was only elected late last year too. So there's kind of a newness in the job for both of them. And in terms of the Pope, Mullally will also visit Rome at the end of next month, which again will cement the friendship between the two.
Catherine, very much. Thank you very much. Catherine Wyatt reporting there for us. Sir James McMillan is one of the most distinguished voices in contemporary classical music, a composer whose work has marked key moments of national and spiritual significance, from the late Queen's funeral to Pope Benedict's visit to Britain. His latest piece, Angels Unawares, is a vast new oratorio in 12 movements, tracing mysterious encounters with angels across both the Old and New Testaments. Written for Harry Christopher's and the Sixtine, it received its world premiere last week in the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican. In fact, you can hear that performance tonight at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3. And ahead of that, I'll be speaking to James McMillan about entertaining angels unawares beneath Michelangelo's famous ceiling.
I didn't know when I was writing the music that the music would go to the Sistine Chapel, so I had no idea what the setting would be, what the sound would be like, and in fact, the musicians had no idea what the sound quality, the acoustic would be like until the first notes of the first rehearsals in both cases. We were pleasantly surprised. We expected our very swimmy, boomy acoustic where everything was getting lost, but that wasn't the case at all. There was a degree of clarity, especially this time, because we needed it, because there was trumpets and drums in the new piece, so it needed to be very clear.
Angels Unawares is based on a poem, really a sequence of poems, isn't it, by the late poet and priest Robert Willis, who served as Dean of Canterbury Cathedral. You didn't get to meet Robert Willis, did you?
No, I didn't, and I very much regret that. We liaised through email on this piece. He sent me the text as it emerged. And then, tragically, he died very shortly after completing the text. So it was a great loss to all of us, mainly because, to people like me and musicians, he wrote beautifully for the singing voice. There's a special skill in being able to craft words and text that can be sung.
And this is an extended reflection, this sequence of poems, on the famous text in the book of Hebrews, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." It's a very intriguing text, isn't it?
It is, and Robert's poems explore six unexpected angelic encounters in the Old Testament, and then six New Testament encounters with angels, mysterious encounters where the subjects don't realise they are in the presence of angels, or they don't realise until it's always too late, until the angel has gone, in some cases, that they're dealing with a messenger from heaven, as it were. And I suppose that quote from Hebrews is a pointer to all of us that these things can happen and that we may not know it, but that angelic messages, as it were, or angelic encounters may indeed be possible, even in our present day, post-religious, some might say post-secular age, when people are beguiled and curious about the idea of angels in our world, regardless of religion and regardless of belief. That the angelic story is there in many of the great religions, and even with agnostic people, a sense of the angelic is something they seem to be thirsty for.
I know you've spoken about an umbilical link between faith and art, or belief in art. Can you describe, James, what that means for you compositionally when you're engaging in your own particular art?
I also believe there's an umbilical link between music and silence. Paradoxically, it's in the silence of our own hearts, the silence of the composer's own contemplations and indeed prayers, that music begins. So it's in that deep silence, that deep contemplation, where perhaps an artist or a composer makes his encounter with the numinous, that the music begins. So I see a very strong, as I say, umbilical connection between what I do in music with that strange sense of the numinous that is beyond us and maybe the root of all art and all imagination.
All this numinous talk brings me to Gregorian chant. You've championed the chant as part of the church's DNA. What do you think Gregorian chant can offer the 21st century composer that modern musical language cannot?
Well, there's something about Gregorian chant that attracts composers even today, and even that's a pure and endless perfect melody, which composers can only aspire to.
If someone comes to Angels Unawares with no connection personally with faith, maybe no connection even in their family for generations, what do you hope they will leave with?
It's a combination of a beautiful singing text written by a modern poet with music of the modern age, which I think strive to speak of ancient things and of primal things, and those primal things are deep within our souls.
Sir James McMillan, and you can hear his oratorio, Angels Unawares, tonight at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3. Prince William's personal religious views made the front pages this week after a palace aide, speaking on his behalf, said that his commitment to the Church of England is sometimes quieter than people expect. Some have taken that to mean that he is not a particularly committed Christian, even though the statement adds his connection to the church and to the sense of duty that comes with it runs deep and is grounded in something personal and sincere, which again sounded just a little coy for some, given that the prince will one day become Supreme Governor of the Church of England and enjoy the title Defender of the Faith. With me to discuss the prince and his attempts to reassure them are Theo Hobson, who writes about religion for The Spectator, and the Reverend Dan Beasley, rector of Chalfont St Giles. Welcome to both of you. Theo, some have used the term quiet faith to describe what we've been told this week about Prince William's attitude to the church and to Christianity. Is that how you would describe it?
No, I think that phrase is misleading, really, because overall the comments show that he's agnostic and he kind of wants to present himself as that. I suppose you could call him a cultural Christian because he emphasizes duty to the church. But in fact, he sounds a bit uncomfortable about that label as well. The main thing is he wants to sound authentic rather than just conformist, going through the motions like you might expect of a previous era. So he's in a bit of a dilemma because he wants to appeal to, you know, a young agnostic people for whom authenticity is everything, but he can't do that too strongly.
Dan, And I mean this sort of constitutionally rather than in terms of spirituality, but does it matter if the future Supreme Governor of the Church of England has any personal, private Christian faith? It is a role, obviously, in the Constitution, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think, to be honest, if we look back throughout history, could we really say that every monarch has had a deep personal faith,
exactly,
that they acted in a Christian way? And so that's a key thing here. You know, a couple of years ago in Robert Hardman's book, The Making of a King, it was said that he didn't want to be head of the Church of England. And now he's making indications that he is. So there is movement there. But I would say that, yeah, it would be better for me, especially as a parish priest, to have the head of the Church of England as a practicing Christian.
Theo, perhaps we're expecting too much clarity about personal belief from someone like Prince William, given the unusual role he's destined to inherit.
Yeah, I think in a way we are, and we should respect the fact that he's in this unique position.
Yeah.
And you imagine growing up knowing that your future role said you had to be a certain sort of Christian, you'd kick against it probably and be anything but, or at least sort of try out the other possibilities. So I do feel for him, but ultimately, you know, he does have this role, you know, if he's going to accept it. And in future, I think he has to be a bit more circumspect about his own beliefs and give the impression that he is a quiet Christian rather than a secret agnostic. And of course, it's an impossible role religiously, because you have to appeal to a diverse nation, or rather you have to try to represent them. And we saw his father doing that through being a bit alternative and a bit of pagan spirituality and this sort of thing to appeal beyond the Church of England. And in a way, he's just trying to find his own way of being wider than any one single position. But I think in future, he should do it a bit more carefully. That, I think, the comments were too close to he just an agnostic who doesn't really have much feeling for religion.
Dan, did you read those comments in that way, to the extent that they were suggestive of agnosticism rather than a kind of quietude?
I read it that he's, well, again, going back to a couple of years ago when the comments were coming out from that book, that he didn't really have much faith.
Yeah.
That he's trying to draw a line in the sand. That's what I heard, that he has a private faith. But you know what I understand, Christianity is a journey. And I was an atheist for 20 years before I became a Christian. Now I'm a vicar in the Church of England. You know, so any movement, any thought about faith, and especially for William putting something out so publicly to say, well, there might be something there. You know, we can't read his heart. We don't know. Christianity is a personal faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, and coming to know him and declaring that. But it is a journey. So we pray for him every week, obviously, in the church, or well, every day, and the king, and we hope that they will become the defender of the faith and a committed Christian. But it is also, and we have to say this, the responsibility of the church to defend the faith, not, as Theo said, to put it upon one person who will then say, well, this is your job, mate. You have to do it.
And Theo, the context here is also that Cyril Mullally was installed this week. These comments are connected, aren't they, to that moment. And just as church leaders, from archbishops to street pastors, will be involved inevitably in responding to key national events or key crises like the terrible tragedy in Derby last night, described by some people there as carnage and horrific, there will be an expectation that the church and the Crown will have a kind of an alliance in speaking for the nation and pastoring the nation.
Yeah, that's right. That's part of his role, to represent the common culture, the tradition in that way. And of course, it is a time where common culture is problematic. But I think if he is more of a cultural Christian than a believing one, he could be more articulate about why the Church of England matters to the nation. I think in those comments, there wasn't much of that. He just sounded as if, oh, it matters to other people, to their faith, and to have good faith communities. But actually, he could say that the church is deeply involved in British values, that it's at the heart of our liberal tradition, all that sort of thing. And he must learn to speak well on that partly to deflect from too much attention on his own faith.
And Dan, maybe he will. Maybe he'll find his voice in some of those areas. But is it fair to say he's also a bit of a cultural weather vane because he represents many of his own generation, the millennial kind of generation of people who may be small air spiritual but are not connected organisationally?
Yeah, he does. I think he really does represent where Britain is and how they see Christianity as a faith. And he probably is just speaking into where a lot of people are. And we have to recognise that, both culturally, but also as a church. But not everyone's lost. And that's the hope for the future, isn't it? And that's the hope for Prince William as well.
Dan Beasley, Theo Hobson, thank you both very much. British Muslims preparing for Hajj this year, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, are being warned about a rise in sophisticated online scams, including fake websites imitating the official Saudi Nasuk platform. The journalist Lucas Kamiski has been tracking those developing scams. He's an investigative reporter with the news and culture site Hyphen. Lucas, good morning. Tell us what you find out in your investigation.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show to discuss this important issue today. So for Hyphen, I obtained data from the City of London Police, which leads nationally on fraud policing. This revealed that 34 Hajj-related fraud reports were made through the force's Action Fraud self-reporting tool in 2025. Aspiring pilgrims told police that they had been swindled out of nearly £200,000 last year, which is up by about 30% on the £150,000 of Hajj-related fraud reports in 2024. So the highest individual loss reported last year was £64,000, the data show.
And that's, those are just the ones we know about?
These are just the ones we know about. I mean, as I was going to say, these are clearly vast sums of money with devastating real-world impacts on the victims, you know, many of whom will have been saving up for years to make their pilgrimage. It's worth remembering this is considered to be a spiritual duty that must be performed by every Muslim at least once in their lifetime, so long as they're financially, physically and emotionally able to do so. But I mean, as you say, experts warn these figures are likely to just be the tip of the iceberg, as true losses are likely to be many times higher. So City of London Police believe this fraud type continues to be underreported.
Lucas, just very briefly, could you explain what the official Nasuk website is and whether it's helped to reduce some of the related fraud?
Sure, yeah. So Nasuk is the Saudi government's official website for booking all-inclusive Hajj packages. So that can include services such as visa issuance, flights, accommodation, catering, transport and guidance. So pilgrims traveling to Mecca from eligible countries, including the UK, can only book a Hajj place through this platform. City of London Police told me that since the website was rolled out in 2022, it's coincided with a decline in reports of Hajj-related fraud. Right. They told me that prior to this, and I quote, there were issues with sort of a minority of backstreet agents or dodgy agents selling packages they couldn't or were never going to
look at. Thank you very much. I'm breaking in only because, thank you very much, Lucas Kamiski. Breaking in only because we have been talking to the City of London Police. Barwatu Ibrahim from the Sunday programme spoke to Detective Chief Inspector Kevin Ives, the national lead for Hajj fraud there.
In terms of the numbers in comparison to the overall number of pilgrims that travel from the UK, they are thankfully low. But what we should never do is reduce these things to numbers, because each one of those victims, each one of those pounds is someone or money that's been saved to try to go on the pilgrimage, the journey of a lifetime. And so the impact of each and every one of those numbers is huge. As we know, the Saudi government brought in Nusuk and their intentions there were fantastic. They were looking to stop a lot of the issues that nations, including the UK, had with backstreet bad actors selling pilgrimages that didn't exist. And they have had a lot of success there, but I fear that what we're seeing is that fraud methods are adapting and changing. Now, what we fear is that it does introduce for fraudsters potentially to have fake websites to guide unwitting pilgrims to fake Nusuk websites, to introduce intermediaries where they're not needed in the process and to take money from pilgrims. And so we're really looking to push our messages of only booking through the official Nusuk website. And if you're not sure where to find that, go via the UK Foreign Office website, who host a link to the genuine website. And any agency you use, you've got to research them before, and you've got to keep your receipts and you've got to keep your proof of payments.
My understanding is that some of these fraudsters are actually abroad. And so if offenders are often or sometimes abroad or even anonymous, what can the police realistically do? And what does a successful intervention look like for this campaign?
So it's important to remember that, yes, as police, we're here to arrest people if we can, but there's lots of things we can do. If we have a fake website concerned, we can quite often remove that website. We can shut it down. We can potentially use tools to interfere financially with proven fraudsters. But also we do work with other police forces. We work with people like Interpol and Europol and other police forces around the world. So we are not totally at a loss if we have a foreign criminal, but we need to know about that first, and we need all the information we can get from the public to help us do that.
The problem, hedge fraud, is chronically underreported, with some estimates suggesting as few as 3% of victims ever coming forward. Why do you think people aren't reporting?
I think there are several reasons why harsh fraud has remained unreported, but certainly there are factors such as shame, such as having completed a pilgrimage but have lost lots of money on it, and then feeling that because that's not important, if you've completed your pilgrimage, then it's not important that you pay too much for it, then people may not report it for that reason. It's a very difficult fraud to live with. This is something that will remain with people for their whole lives if the chance to complete this journey has been taken away from them. So it's very impactive. It's a very emotive issue. And I think all of those feed into why we suspect that there is underreporting.
Finally, though, what practical steps should pilgrims take to protect themselves from when booking this year's Hajj?
Number one, only book through that official Nusuk website using the Foreign Office link to make sure you're at the right one there. Remember that you don't need to use an intermediary. You can just book using the Nusuk website. Make sure you keep all records of payments and receipts so that you can prove who you've paid any monies to, and avoid paying in cash at all costs. And really lastly, and really importantly for us, is that if you've been a victim or even know someone who has been, do not suffer in silence. You must report it to the police. The best place to report, and the only real place to report if you have been a victim of this or someone you know has, is reportfraud.police.uk.
DCI Kevin Ives there. It's 25 minutes to 8. Still to come this morning, Palm Sunday processions will be taking place all across the world today, but not at the site of the original Palm Sunday in Jerusalem.
Ring the alarm bells. Tell everyone that the numbers and statistics show a very steady decline of the Palestinian Christian population.
A Victorian painting of Jesus holding a lamb sold at auction this week for more than £250,000. The Good Shepherd by the 19th century Scottish artist William Dyce, described by some historians as a Christian polymath, had been owned by the Church of St. Peter in Little Budworth in Cheshire. The parish will be grateful for the cash injection, of course, but that's not why they sold it in the first place. In fact, they had previously offered it free on permanent loan to any art gallery that wanted to display it, but they all said no. I spoke this weekend to the vicar of St. Peter's, the Reverend Paul Dawson, and Serena Trowbridge, Professor of Pre-Raphaelite Studies at Birmingham University, about the Good Shepherd's journey from parish church to private ownership.
Well, it was given to the church in 1925 in memory of James Henry Stock. His family gave it to the church. It was in the church for many years. We're not entirely sure when it left, but it's at least 50 years ago, in a rather poor state. Went to Liverpool, was restored there, then went to Manchester, was exhibited there. And after many years, they contacted us and said, do you know, we've still got this and it's not on display and it sat in a room, and do you want it back?
Well, Serena, for those who haven't seen this painting, could you briskly describe it and tell us if you think it's a powerful example of pre-Raphaelite art?
Yes, yeah, so this was painted after Dyce had come under the influence of the Pre-Raphaelites, so it's very much in their style. And you'd recognise that from this extraordinary attention to detail in the picture. The figure of Christ is at the centre. He's a very medieval figure with bright clothes and the expected detailing on the fabrics. Around that, there is extraordinary closely painted sheep's fleeces and ivy leaves. And he gazes, the figure of Christ gazes at this lamb in his arms with this tender expression on his face. And he's returning that lamb to the flock. So the allegory is very clear. Dice was a man of science as well as a man of faith, and we can see that in these details in this and in other paintings. So it is a powerful example of that sort of religious painting.
And Paul, it's also a rather lovely painting. Why are you trying to sell it?
It's a beautiful painting. We're delighted that somebody has bought this who can cherish it, enjoy it, and protect it. We can do the first two, and we have a wonderful reproduction of it in church to enjoy, but we can't protect it. When it was in St. Peter's, which is a beautiful rural church, but like many rural churches, is not heated for most of the week, tends to get quite cold and can be quite damp, and the painting deteriorated, which is why I went to Liverpool in the first place. And we thought, if it comes back here, our building is just not designed to properly protect a work of art of this nature. And we thought it'd be much better if it could go somewhere where it can be protected. We did try many galleries to see if people wanted it. Unfortunately, we had no luck with that for a variety of reasons. And we thought the best thing to do is see if it can be sold. And then the intention will be for the funds it has raised to try and protect the church building to make it more sustainable in the long run.
Serena, do you find it odd that this church has not been able to persuade a gallery to take this on even as a permanent loan?
I think it's a shame, but I don't think it's surprising. Obviously, art galleries are underfunded and understaffed at the moment, and collections management, display and so on is in itself expensive. And galleries have a great deal of work that they're not able to display that's in storage anyway. But I think there's also an argument to be made that, unfortunately, this perhaps doesn't chime with what is currently a trend in art generally, I suppose. I think there is space for that to happen. And as I say, I think that this is a painting with intrinsic value in itself for the art and for what it represents. But I also think that perhaps it doesn't fit in with the displays that are currently active in museums and galleries at the moment.
So essentially, Victorian religious art's sort of fallen out of fashion, Serena.
It's less fashionable than some things. I think there's a big push towards looking at connections between different artists and things like the women artists who've been overlooked for so long. I also think that there is a growing interest, particularly among younger people, in faith and spirituality in all kinds of ways. The Pre-Raphaelites cover quite a range of different beliefs, from the atheist to the Jewish. I think there is space at some point for that to be explored further in galleries.
Paul, have you had a chance to check through all of your loft spaces and your cupboards to make sure you don't have any other significant pieces of art hidden about the place?
We have a very wonderful piece of art that is being explored by a dedicated professional. It was originally said to be a Caravaggio. It's not. It's one of his disciples. It came out of Alton Hall, where there was a tremendous collection. And sadly, Alton Hall burnt to the ground on February the 14th, 1926, which just marked the 100th anniversary of that fire. But it was one work of art which was given to the church from the hall before the fire happened. And it's absolutely amazing piece. It's huge, and it hangs in the north side of the church. We do know it's there, but there aren't any cupboards with anything else hidden away, I'm afraid.
The Reverend Paul Dawson and Serena Trowbridge. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels have carried out a second wave of drone and missile attacks in parts of southern Israel, targeting military sites, they say. Another escalation in the Middle East in a conflict that has also badly affected the Palestinian Christian community there. The Latin Patriarch, Cardinal Pete Zabala, says the traditional Palm Sunday procession has been cancelled because of war restrictions, and other Holy Week events have also been postponed. It comes as the number of Palestinian Christians continues to decline, now below 1% of the population, raising questions about the future of Christianity in its own birthplace. Dalia Kamsia is a human rights lawyer in Bethlehem who has documented the pressures on Christian communities. I asked her how Christians there have responded to the news of a cancelled Palm Sunday procession.
How this is received in the Christian community with a great sense of despair, I would say. We have to put the cancellations in context, really. Much of the cancellations of the Easter celebration has to do with access to the holy sites and the celebrations themselves. And we have been witnessing them going on even well before October the 7th, 2023, to the point where we find ourselves here in 2026, where there are no Easter celebrations. They have been canceled. And for us Palestinian Christians in the West Bank, we have no access to Jerusalem, no permits.
What is the significance of Palm Sunday processions for Palestinian Christians?
It has a great significance. It signals the starting the Holy Week, which has a very special place, not only like, you know, religiously, but also in the identity of Palestinian Christianity. And this year, it feels even a lot more desperate, the fact that we are unable to go to Jerusalem and to celebrate Palm Sunday as Palestinian Christians who live in the West Bank, because Jerusalem has been completely separated and isolated from us. And Jerusalem is a city with great significance for us. You know, the history, the religion, economy, the politics, you know, Jerusalem means a lot. When we talk about separating Jerusalem from Bethlehem, it's really important to know what these two cities signal in the Christian faith. One holds the first pillar, that is Nativity, the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. And the other is the resurrection, it's Jerusalem. And imagine for the first time in 2,000 years, they have been separated physically and administratively. So it's not the first year that we are restricted from, you know, celebrating Palm Sunday, but it is the first year that the entire celebration is canceled. And they impact everyone, but they also have aggravated impacts on Palestinian Christians because they are a decreasing minority to such an alarming rate where we are around 1% of the population or less.
From decreasing to almost disappearing. What are the actual numbers? Can you help us understand just how many Palestinian Christians actually there are?
A rough estimation is 50,000 Palestinian Christians in the occupied Palestinian territory, roughly. This is the land that brought Christianity to the entire world. And this is where you have the first Christians indigenous to this land and to this population being literally eroded out of existence, or at least any meaningful presence. Because we don't want to have, like, you know, we have all these holy sites and churches, and biblically the living stones are the Christians in Palestine. And we are afraid that you will have the stones for the churches, but not the living stones.
Just to be clear, what are the main pressures driving Palestinian Christians to leave today?
So if we look at the history, the first significant blow to Palestinian Christians was the Nakba. The population just before the Nakba of 1948 was between 10 to 12%. And then the year immediately after the Nakba, it became 3%, because the concentration of the Palestinian Christian population was in the north, in the Galilee. And if you ask why, these are our family members, our friends who are leaving on a daily basis. I mean, you have an overall context where there is no dignity for Palestinians, no safety. Our most fundamental rights are being violated systematically, again, as parts of systems on both sides of the green line. And that, given the deteriorating political situation where there are no prospects at this point for any solutions, and when people really lose hope that tomorrow will be a better day, that's when they usually decide to leave. And,
when they leave, where do they go to?
I mean, really, across the globe, to the United States, to Canada, to some to Australia, to Europe, where they have family members, ring the alarm bells, tell everyone that this is a serious problem. The numbers and statistics are very problematic. They show a very steady decline and an increasingly fast decline of the Palestinian Christian population. And without challenging the root causes of why Palestinian Christians are pushed out of their homeland.
Dalia Komsia there in Bethlehem. The term quiet revival gained currency amongst many Christians in Britain more than a year ago after a report from the Bible Society claimed that church attendance by young people in England and Wales had skyrocketed from 4% to 16% in just 6 years. From the beginning, those claims were met with incredulity by many experts on religion and demography, some of them speaking on this programme. This week, the Bible Society withdrew the claim of a quiet revival after the data turned out to be flawed. The research was conducted by the analytics company YouGov, who have apologised for the errors. Sir John Curtis, professor at Strathclyde University, has been a vocal sceptic of the quiet revival claims from the beginning.
The quiet revival was saying, in particular, younger people were going to church. There was a revival of spirituality. A long-term social trend had apparently been stopped and reversed. But so far, at least, the evidence doesn't suggest that there is any marked revival about Christianity amongst younger people. What is true, and perhaps in a sense has been rather lost during the course of the whole interest as to whether or not the quiet revival was or wasn't right, is that because our migrant population is younger, because those who identify as a Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist, who of course disproportionately coming from minority population, that amongst younger people, there is a different kind of revival, is a strong word, but a reason as to why religious attendance in general is now not falling away amongst younger people in the way that we might anticipated 20 years ago. And that is that basically younger Muslims, younger Buddhists, etc., young Hindus are particularly likely to attend a religious service. So therefore, actually, in terms of overall religious observance, as opposed to Christian observance, the age differences do seem to have narrowed. But it's not necessarily for the reasons that the Bible Society were hoping were true in the wake of their YouGov data.
John Curtis there. And listening to that, Paul Williams, Chief Executive at the Bible Society. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, William. Thanks for having me on the show this morning.
Yeah, well, now that this data, Paul, has been discredited, does the Bible Society feel some measure of embarrassment by how strongly the quiet revival narrative took off or was pushed?
No, I don't think we feel embarrassed. We feel very frustrated and disappointed at the errors that were made by YouGov that have just recently come to light. We have sought to act, and I believe we have acted, with integrity and professionalism and transparency at every stage in this. So I'm not feeling embarrassed about the way in which the report was, the analysis of the report and the reporting was done. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but, you know, we handled the
data is it hindsight?
With integrity.
Is it hindsight, though? You say that you were told by YouGov, what, a month ago, that the data was problematic. But you were told a year ago by many, many experts that this data could not possibly match up with what else we know from other demographic surveys. For example, Professor David Vos challenged the claims, indeed, on this programme at the outset and said, we've been telling them, you, the Bible Society, for the better part of a year that there were serious problems with the data and even what those problems were likely to be, and they refused to engage with us. So I wonder, did you just want this quiet narrative, this quiet revival narrative, to be true? Was there a degree of confirmation bias, Paul, in your response to it?
No, I don't accept that. I understand that's it's a reasonable question to ask, but no, I don't accept that we've done that. And there are a number of features of the narrative you've just given that I would like to just gently challenge. First of all, we are Bible Society. Our focus is on the Bible, and the reason we undertook the research was to understand attitudes to the Bible. We weren't looking for data on church attendance, so we didn't come at this with a particular viewpoint on that in the first place. The second thing to say,
but you were arguing that there was a quiet revival when the evidence points to the contrary.
Let's be clear. We've withdrawn the report because we know that it statistically cannot be relied on because of the errors in the data that YouGov admitted. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we are saying that all the findings in the report are wrong. And I'm afraid there is, in fact, despite what David Vos may say, there is a lot of evidence that young people in particular, yeah, but not only young people, are newly coming to faith in this country.
Well, Paul, sorry to break we're nearly out of time. I know you're not withdrawing that, but when I have read your most recent report, and in there you give examples to try to back up that claim, and one of the examples you give is that Richard Dawkins now calls himself a cultural Christian. Well, I have to say to you, Paul, Richard Dawkins has been calling himself a cultural Christian for about 20 years. I did a TV interview with him about 15 years ago when he used that phrase. He's even used the term Christian atheist. That doesn't mean that he's part of a quiet revival.
Of course it doesn't, and that isn't what we say in the report. What we do say in the report, William, is that, for example, there is a Pew study which uses the methodology that David Vose appreciates, that is probability surveys rather than opt-in panels like YouGov. And the Pew study analysis shows a higher incidence of religiosity amongst young people, Christian practice, prayer, Bible reading, and church attendance. That data has been given to David Vose, to Conrad Hackett, who's another critic, right, and to the BBC, and they've refused to engage with that data.
We should. We should. We'll take a look at it.
There are the
challenge accepted. Challenge accepted. We'll take a look at it, Paul. Thank you very much. From the Bible Society there, Paul Williams. And that is it from this week's Sunday. We'll be back again, of course, on Easter Sunday next week. Say hello on social media, BBC R4 Sunday. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Bada Artu Ibrahim and Linda Walker. Now, actress Maxine Peake makes this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Amos Trust.
When dusk settles, hundreds of teenage girls gather around a football stadium in Tanzania every night, not to watch a game, but to try and earn some money through sex work. This is where 22-year-old Dira, not her real name, ended up. Dira was just 13 when she lost her parents to HIV. She was left looking after a younger sister who'd also contracted the virus. Their aunts and uncles had abandoned them as the stigma was too great. And Dira became the main caregiver and provider while she was still a child herself. Instead of going to school and learning her times tables, she tried to make ends meet. But without family support or a regular income, Dira would lie awake at night worrying how they were going to survive. Sheer desperation led her to the streets and eventually to the football stadium looking for customers. She felt terrified and ashamed and hated herself for doing it, but she couldn't see a future. Then her sister died, and Dira discovered she was pregnant. That's when Gloria from Amos Trust's local partner organisation met Dira on the streets, grieving and alone. They provided her with a safe place to live, offered her counselling and held her hand as she gave birth to her son. In time, they taught her how to sew, gave her a sewing machine and helped her rent a workspace for 6 months. Now, I'm pleased to tell you, Dira owns 6 machines and has built a successful dressmaking business. She's teaching other girls just like her, passing on skills to help them rebuild their lives and to give hope. Dira says she's found her smile and her voice again and is living the future she once thought was impossible. For many years, I've been inspired by the way Amos Trust helps hundreds of young women like Dira realise their potential. But there are hundreds more standing by the football stadium each night who urgently need your support. Whatever you can give will make a massive difference, and 2 charitable trusts will match each pound you donate up to £10,000. You can give now by searching online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or calling 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Amos Trust and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Please mark the back of your envelope, Amos Trust. Thank you.
Maxine Peake, and the number to call again, 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and also from mobiles. And you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want Amos Trust to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Let's get a weather update now. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Neil. Good morning.
Well, the sun has risen now on the first day of British summer time, and the sun won't set until between about 7:30 and 8 p.m. this evening. So I think we'll enjoy those longer, lighter evenings. But it's certainly not feeling very summer-like out there today, because we've got a band of rain tracking south across the UK. It is going to be another windy day, and it'll feel quite chilly for the time of year too. So for Scotland and Northern Ireland, first off, persistent heavy bursts of rain, windy weather here, some drier weather anywhere to the east of higher ground. But that rain will track its way south, and as we head through the day, we'll see sunshine reappearing, but also some heavy showers packing in, particularly across central parts of Scotland. Some are falling as snow, and there'll be some hail, particularly over the higher ground. For northern England into Wales, the Midlands, as well as southwest England, well, here most places are dry at the moment, but increasing amounts of cloud, and it's been a chilly start to the day. Over the next few hours, the rain will push its way from north to south, becoming quite patchy as it reaches the far south, but more persistent for the hills of Wales, northern England as well, and it is going to be windy. For the southeast of England and East Anglia, though, it's here that we'll keep the clearest skies for longest. After a chilly start to the morning, hazy sunshine around, cloud thickens into the afternoon, and there'll be some patchy rain later on in the day, but any showers here fairly few and far between. Now, temperature-wise, across the UK today, we're looking at 7 or 8 across the north of Scotland, most of us about 10 to 12, but probably the warmest spot, Northern Ireland, that'll get up to about 13 degrees as the sunshine reappears this afternoon. But the wind's a real feature, gusting about 30 to 50 miles an hour, but could be as high as 60 miles an hour in the north of Scotland. Now, through tonight, showers and cloud clear away from the south. Still some ongoing wintry showers across parts of Scotland. Temperatures down to about 2 to 5 degrees, but it will turn a little drier and warmer over the next few days.
Many thanks, Sarah Keith Lucas. Now, with news of Broadcasting House at 9 o'clock, here's Paddy O'Connell. Good morning, Paddy.
Neil, you'll notice I'm wearing a tie.
You are looking dapper, Paddy.
Thank you, which you seem to have lost yours. But good morning. I put it on because Kemi Badenoch's coming into the studio. I thought I should dress up. We're asking senior figures if they want more decency in British politics. That's a long-running theme on BH. We'll also be giving listeners the latest on the Iran war. We celebrate Mick Ronson, one of rock's most famous guitarists, and we celebrate the Dipper, the short, stout songbird which can swim underwater. Our headliners are coming in. They're Helen Sharman, the astronaut, Kirsty Walk, the broadcaster, and Carrie Ad Lloyd, the podcast queen. And when the clocks changed, we were in the room where it happened.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 29th of March. Good morning, this is Lisa Costello. Police have arrested the driver of a car that struck a number of pedestrians in the centre of Derby. Iranian-backed Houthis have said they'll keep launching strikes against Israel, raising fears of further disruption to the world economy. Keir Starmer has signalled he'd like to ban addictive algorithms for young people on social media. A number of people have been injured, some seriously, after a car struck pedestrians in Derby city centre. The driver has been arrested. Lee Milner has the latest.
The incident happened at 9:30 last night on Friar Gate. It's one of the main historic streets in Derby city centre and would have been busy with people and traffic. It's understood a black Suzuki Swift car struck multiple pedestrians. Some are believed to be seriously hurt. Many were treated at the scene before being taken to hospital. In a statement, police said there wasn't an ongoing risk to the public, but Friar Gate is currently closed and drivers are being told to avoid the area. A man in his 30s has been arrested and is in custody. Officers say they're still in the early stages of their investigation and the motive behind the incident is unclear. They're asking anyone who saw the car to come forward. The Labour MP for Derby North, Catherine Atkinson, said on social media this morning that she was deeply shocked and her thoughts were with those who'd been injured.
Iranian-backed Houthi militias in Yemen have warned they'll keep targeting Israel in the coming days after launching their first attacks since the war in the Middle East began a month ago. The Houthis' decision to join the conflict has led to fears of further disruption to the world economy. Our correspondent Sebastian Usher is monitoring developments from Jerusalem.
Now in its second month, the war shows little sign of slackening on all fronts, including the new one opened by the Houthis in Yemen. The Iranian-backed movement has fired a second volley of missiles and drones at Israel. An even bigger concern about the group's belated entry into the conflict is that it might try to close off the key commercial waterway, the Bab al-Mandab Strait in the Red Sea, heaping further pain on the global economy. Iran has fired more missiles at its Gulf neighbours in the past few hours. It's also warned that it could target Israeli and American universities in the Middle East in response to an alleged strike on a university in Tehran. There are reports of two explosions in the Iranian capital this morning as the US-Israeli air offensive continues.
Iran has continued to fire missiles and drones at targets in Gulf countries. There were reports of renewed strikes overnight in Qatar, Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. In Bahrain, one of the world's largest producers of aluminium, Alba, said it was assessing the damage caused by an attack on its facilities. The Conservatives are launching a Get Britain Drilling campaign, calling for the UK to maximise the use of its oil and gas reserves to bring energy bills down. The party leader, Kemi Badenoch, wants an end to the moratorium on new oil and gas licences and a scrapping of the windfall tax on energy profits. But the Energy Minister, Michael Shanks, said the Conservatives' own energy spokeswoman had admitted that new North Sea licences would not take a penny off bills. England's largest education union says large class sizes and a lack of staff are stopping teachers from properly supporting children with special educational needs and disabilities. The National Education Union says its teacher survey demonstrates mainstream schools are not properly resourced to cope with the demand. The government says it's investing £4 billion of extra funding over the next 3 years to improve SEND provision. But the union's General Secretary, Daniel Kebbedee, says teachers are overstretched.
Teachers and support staff want to see an inclusive school system. The problem is they are just so overstretched. They are being asked to do much more with less resource. It becomes an impossibility. And that in turn actually is driving educators out of the profession. We're not delivering for the workforce, but most importantly, we're not delivering for the children that access schools every day either.
Sir Keir Starmer has signalled the government is prepared to act to try to stop social media companies using addictive functions that keep young people hooked, saying such features shouldn't be permitted. In an interview with the Sunday Mirror, the Prime Minister said last week's jury verdict against Meta and Google could mark a turning point, leading to much stricter content restriction. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
The government is currently holding a public consultation on whether to ban social media for the under-16s and other possible restrictions. But the direction of travel seems clear. While Sir Keir Starmer said he was open-minded about a ban, he said the next generation would not forgive the government if it did not act. Addictive features like infinite scrolling and autoplay could be in ministers' sights. Last week, Meta and Google were held liable in a landmark legal case in the US that found social media platforms were designed to be addictive to children, a decision Sir Keir described as a turning point. Both companies have said they will appeal. The Conservatives have said they would introduce an under-16 social media ban, while the Lib Dems said urgent action was needed to protect children.
A reminder that the clocks have gone forward an hour, marking the start of British summertime. A ferry that's crossed the River Mersey for 67 years will sail for the final time today. In her decades-long career, the Royal Iris of the Mersey has played host to famous bands, royalty, and carried generations of passengers, as Lydia Dowling-Ranera reports.
People have been travelling by boat on the River Mersey for hundreds of years, with the earliest crossings organised by Benedictine monks in 1150 AD. The Royal Iris launched in 1959 and 5 years later was featured in the film Ferry Cross the Mersey, where Gerry and the Pacemakers sang their famous song.
So ferry, cross the Mersey, cause this land's the place I love.
The Beatles were formed on the ferry in the early 1960s, and the late Queen Elizabeth II was welcomed aboard in 1977. The Royal Iris also featured in the opening credits of the sitcom The Liverbirds, and even played a part in the 2012 Olympic torch relay. Mersey ferries say she'll be replaced by the new Royal Daffodil later this year, continuing an 800-year-old tradition.
So ferry. Mary, cross the Mersey.
Time for a look at this morning's papers and the news that a man has been arrested after several people were struck by a car in Derby city centre came too late for the papers, but is reflected on their websites. The Telegraph quotes one witness who said it was absolute carnage, adding that there were people lying in the road and on the pavement. Another person described the scene as utterly horrific. Reporters for Derbyshire Live at the site said an eerie stillness then took over as people tried to come to terms with what had happened. According to the Sunday Times, Britain is preparing to deploy a Royal Navy ship retrofitted with mine-hunting drones to the Strait of Hormuz. It's understood the vessel would, in effect, act as what the paper calls a mothership for equipment, housing specialist technology that could scan the seabed for threats, disarm mines and survey surrounding waters. The paper quotes a defence source as saying that a decision is still to be made on whether the vessel will be sent, but it gives ministers options. The front page of the Mail on Sunday says as many as 70 people from Britain have been arrested in the United Arab Emirates for taking what it calls war photos. The paper claims that some are being deprived of sleep, food and medicine after taking pictures of Iranian drone and missile attacks. There's a report in the Sunday Times that Royal Mail would like to remove a cap that limits annual increases to the price of a second-class stamp. The safeguard, which has been in place since the company was privatised more than a decade ago, has meant the price of a second-class stamp has only risen from 50 pence to 91 pence. No such cap exists on the price of a first-class stamp, which has sharply increased from 60 pence to £1.80 from next month. The Sunday Telegraph reports that Sir Keir Starmer's former chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, has been told to hand over any relevant messages from his personal mobile phone relating to Lord Mandelson. The request comes as the government deals with a promise to release communications regarding the peer's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. Mr. McSweeney's government phone was stolen last year. The Sunday Times reports that Prince Harry is hopeful the King will invite him, as well as his wife and two young children, to spend some family time in Norfolk this summer. A friend of the Prince says this would ensure security was in place for the family while in Britain, a service that's under review due to Prince Harry and Meghan stepping back as working royals in 2020. The actor and comedian Miranda Hart is being touted as a replacement for Claudia Winkleman on Strictly Come Dancing, according to The Sun on Sunday. The paper says she's held secret talks with the BBC about joining the programme, with sources telling the paper her sense of humour would make her a perfect fit. And that's the news and papers this Sunday morning.
Many thanks, Lisa Costello. This is BBC Radio 4. Today's Witness History remembers the first pilot to fly faster than the speed of sound. That's coming up at 10 to 9. Now, time for Sunday worship, which continues a journey through Lent today, marking Palm Sunday with reflections from an ancient Scottish pilgrim route.
Welcome to Sunday Worship, as we trace the footsteps of thousands of pilgrims here in Fife. I'm Sally Foster Fulton, a former moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. This was one of the most important pilgrim routes in medieval Europe, leading towards veneration of the relics of St. Andrew in the now-ruined St. Andrew's Abbey on Scotland's east coast. Our exploration of parts of the route starts here in the beautiful village of Curis, on the northern shore of the River Forth. On Palm Sunday, those journeying through Lent step into Holy Week. Lent is a sacred pilgrimage, personal reflection and public proclamation of our intent to stay with Jesus. When the sky darkens like an angry mood, after the palm branches dry up and blow away, as the worshipful shouts of Hosanna turn towards wayward whispers, we will walk with him to the end. The question Palm Sunday always asks, can you stay with him? I'm joined on my walks along some of the Fife Pilgrim Way by historian and theologian Gilbert Marcus.
Good morning. We're in Kouros, beautiful old village, at the heart of which, or rather at the top end of which, is the ruin of the Cistercian monastery, which was founded by the Earl of Fife, Malcolm, in 1217. There's some lovely, massive medieval stonework all around us here as we sit in the sun.
Gilbert, I know that when we started walking up here, both of us were thinking about what life must have been like here. It's so peaceful and quiet, and these massive stones and archways and paths.
Yes, it was very busy. And it wouldn't just be pilgrims coming here, it would be tradesmen and traders and local people and visitors from afar and business going on. And we should try to hear the echo of all that bustle somehow in these old stones. It's the way from the west to get into Fife. And I think there must have been a bit of a buzz. There were lots of people on the roads and they were going through farms and they were being welcomed by people. I think this is a very important part of the whole pilgrimage thing. We think about people hoping for a blessing that would arise from that. But also I think it's important to remember these local places that they were passing through recognised what they were doing, and they were hoping for a blessing from their pilgrims. Wow. You know, when you welcome strangers, you welcome angels unaware. People felt that. There's a lovely expression in Hungarian, Isten hozat, means God sent you. It's a way of saying, welcome to my place. When somebody comes and knocks at your door, you say, God sent you. It's very important to me, that little phrase in Hungarian, because my father was a Hungarian Jewish refugee who came here to escape the Holocaust. And that little phrase has haunted me, really. What a marvellous sense of what our receptivity and hospitality and openness to strangers, those who are different, those who don't belong here, the idea that God sent them and that places an obligation on us. It places in our imagination the possibility of a recognition of Christ, if you like. If you welcome the stranger, you welcome me. And I think that's how people treat the pilgrims. And so there was a whole lacework of routeways and churches like this who would offer hospitality, food, drink, shelter, medical attention for your blisters if you needed it, you know, and your response to them is an opportunity for you to respond to him.
So, Gilbert, I think both of us share a bit of an anorak nature when it comes to words. And I was really intrigued about that etymology of pilgrim.
Well, peregrinus is an old Latin word which referred originally to people who lived in the empire and were subject to all the political and economic and legal restraints of the empire, but did not have citizenship themselves and therefore didn't have full legal rights, and they were outsiders in some sense. They were vulnerable, they were exposed, and didn't have access to power in the way that a citizen had. So that's the origin of the term, and it perhaps sheds an interesting light on something about the individual pilgrim in the Middle Ages, who've adopted this word about their own state in life, and perhaps that vulnerability is a moment of grace for people. The process of doing that, of emptying yourself, is a kind of imitation of Christ. Our Lenten readings start off with the temptations in the desert, when Christ is tempted by power and he walks away from that. Get behind me, Satan. And he spends the rest of his ministry heading ultimately towards what we're remembering this week, which is his entry into Jerusalem and what's going to happen to him at the end of that. That's Christ's pilgrimage of the Incarnation.
So we've ambled down through the cobbled streets of Kouros, and it was quite contained. You couldn't see very much, and then the vista just opens wide onto the water and the mud flats there.
Good morning.
Good morning. They're absolutely teeming with wildlife.
And this little promontory here, of course, is the origin of the name Kouros. In medieval Gaelic, it's Cúlan Ros, the holly tree promontory. We've been up at the 13th century Cistercian monastery, but there are early medieval carvings in that building which show that there was a church there long before that. The story is that Saint Cerf, who founded the original monastery here, was on the south side of the Forth, and he was standing at Kinneil, the east end of Antonine's Wall, and he threw his stick across the Forth, and it's, I don't know, about a mile and a half, 2 miles, something like that. You can just about see it from here. And it fell here and planted itself and became a fruit tree, and it was miraculous and wonderful to behold. Anyway, that's the story. But what's interesting, his stick was actually presumably his bishop's crozier, and it came across here. And this is at the time when the Northumbrian attempt to control Pictland had failed. And I think that story of the staff being hurled across the water, he's replanting episcopal authority in Pictland.
Pilgrimage calls you to journey with intent, connecting the movement and the moment with deeper questions, deeper meaning. You cross a bridge and consider, are there bridges you've burned that need to be rebuilt? Are there vast expanses keeping you from someone or something precious? Is there troubled water or dangerous territory underneath that needs reckoned with? You reach a crossroads and conjure with choices made, paths chosen. What will your next step be? Who will it impact, for better or worse? You notice the aches associated with a steep climb, a long stretch, a scramble over scree or stones big enough to cause you to consider every next step. And you remember those times in your life when you looked back and thought, phew, made it. You reach a vista, a thin place that opens your vision wide. And you see clearly where you've been and the winding wild paths you've weathered. You're given a glorious glimpse of what lies ahead. Roads your feet may never travel, but are waiting for others who will come after your journey has ended. You slow down and wonder who walked this way before. Wondering, what an underestimated verb. We wonder, so pilgrimage is more than a wandering. It is a wondering.
Christ, you keep asking us to be still, to listen for your voice, to think before we act or speak, to keep our feet firmly on the ground so they have a chance of staying out of our mouths.
But we go racing ahead, blithely ignoring your call for caution or calm. Far too often, instead of abiding in you, we go it alone, and end up with a lot of backtracking to do. During this most holy time, help us to stay near you. Earlier, I spoke with Mairead Nicra. What are we doing when we walk as a pilgrim? Is it wandering or is it that wondering?
I think there's a difference between wandering aimlessly and wandering on a pilgrim path, which usually has a set beginning and a set destination, but in between you have that flexibility. Your wandering is a way of knowing. Your wandering is a way of knowing. And a lot of Indigenous peoples would talk about knowing the land through movement, not through maps, but through walking the land and through movement. So I think being a pilgrim is specifically about movement in space along the land, but also a movement in time in yourself, when maybe you look backwards or maybe you look forwards. Sometimes people go on a pilgrimage at a time of transition in their lives. Perhaps they've lost someone, perhaps they've got married. I know when my husband got a job years ago, the first thing he did was he went on a pilgrimage to Iona.
Oh, wow.
So I think people take time to think, but also time to move.
Oh, I think that's beautiful. I know as a pilgrim, you know, oftentimes people say, oh, you're taking some time out when actually, are you taking time in?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think when we talk about going on holidays or going on a pilgrimage, we say, I'm taking some time out. But actually, when I go on holidays, the one person that always comes with me is me. So I'm stuck with me wherever I go. So when I have time, then I have time in, time to reflect, time to figure out where I'm going, what I'm doing. So I like to think of it as time in rather than time out.
Mm-hmm. Raid, you're a professor of public folklore at the University of the Highlands and Islands.
Yes.
So you must have come across so many stories about people expressing and deepening their faith through that travelling across the land and drawing from important landmarks.
Yes, I mean, there are so many important stories and beautiful pilgrim places. I also have a brother, Michael, who does pilgrimages a lot. Mm-hmm. And for many years, he did Lough Derg in Ireland, which is a very tough pilgrimage. It's, you know, water and brown toast, no sleeping. But it was always such a landmark in the year for him, mm-hmm. this ritual of going to Lough Derg. And despite the hardship of the pilgrimage, he always came back absolutely ecstatic. Mm-hmm. There was some sort of transformation that took place during that pilgrimage. The going through of the hardship transformed him into something new.
Let's hear the reading from Matthew's Gospel, where the Palm Sunday story of Jesus' journey is told.
When they had come near Jerusalem and had reached Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go into the village ahead of you, and immediately you'll find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, just say this, 'The Lord needs them.' And he will send them immediately." This took place to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet. "Tell the daughter of Zion, 'Look, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey and on a colt, the foal of a donkey.'" The disciples went and did as Jesus had directed them. They brought the donkey and the colt and put their cloaks on them, and he sat on them. A very large crowd spread their cloaks on the road, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. The crowds that went ahead of him and that followed were shouting, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord! Hosanna in the highest heaven!" When he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was in turmoil, asking, "Who is this?" The crowds were saying, "This is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth in Galilee."
What'll it be? Choose. In this vast whirling world we wake up in for a few brief decades, what do our minute decisions matter? Aren't they simply swallowed up in the strong tide of time? We are so very temporary. So is there a temptation to be seduced by what pleases the moment over what nurtures the spark of eternity nestled deep inside our souls? Isn't it right to focus on what is right in front of us, there for the taking? instead of stretching for the intangible connection of humans to humans becoming. What'll it be? That's a question echoing through the streets of this story. It was Passover, the most sacred week of the Jewish year, and pilgrims flooded into the city. They celebrated Exodus, the liberation of the Jewish people from foreign domination. But they were still under foreign domination, only now it was Rome. Jerusalem was a tinderbox simmering with unrest. To suppress any dissent, every year just before the Passover, Pilate came with 600 soldiers to reinforce the temple garrison. Imagine the procession entering the city, the spectacle of empire. Soldiers, horses, armor, weapons, banners, flags, golden eagles mounted on poles. And the sounds, marching feet, creaking leather, clinking bridles, beating drums, raw power pounding down the street. And on the other side of town, Jesus organizes a different kind of procession. It was carefully planned. Then he rides into Jerusalem on this donkey with his followers cheering him all the way. It was a parody, a deliberate send-up of Pilate's procession. No one who had watched Pilate enter the city would have missed the point. Years before, the prophet Zechariah had spoken about two different kings entering Jerusalem. The warrior king riding on his war horse, and the king of peace who would enter on a donkey. People remembered Zechariah, and they knew exactly what Jesus was doing, and they knew what it meant. Pilate proclaimed the power of empire, the oppression of occupation. Jesus proclaimed the kingdom of God, the coming of peace and justice. One was a massive display of force. The other was a vulnerable but determined collection of peasants. One arrived from the west, the other from the east. They were coming from opposite directions, heading for a collision. John le Carré, the novelist, was once asked how to create an exciting story. He said, you take one character, you take another character, and you put them into collision. And the collision arrives because of how different they are. That's how you get the essence of drama. The cat sat on the mat is not a story. The cat sat on the dog's mat? Well, that's a different matter altogether. We've had an absolutely beautiful morning in Corus and learned so much. I think it's probably time we headed over to Dunfermline.
I think that's a great idea.
Wherever we go, wherever we bide, whatever.
We've come from a lovely walk in Corus, watching that wee village wake up. And now we've cheated a wee bit, and we've come in the car, and we're in Dunfermline Abbey. Again, just a beautiful place.
Hello.
Thank you.
Margaret's remains were here, along with her husband Malcolm, but they were moved at a later date, so they're no longer on site.
So St. Margaret's shrine is very understated. Huge slabs of stone. And what I really love is you've got life going all around it and St. Margaret's shrine right here in the middle of it.
People coming from the west come from Corus and they meet up here with people coming from the south who have come across on the ferry that St. Margaret built. So she set up the Queen's Ferry. That's why it's called the Queen's Ferry. And that was to encourage people to come via here. You know, Margaret has a very bad reputation as being somebody who helped to dissolve the so-called Celtic Christian mm-hmm. tradition and to bring in foreign Roman or foreign continental things. And she brought Benedictines here, for example. Mm-hmm. But she was absolutely devoted to the pre-reform mm-hmm. people who she thought were doing the right thing. So she spent a lot of time visiting hermits, in, you know, Cayley Jay probably, okay. these kind of early Gallic hermits and recluses and people. And she supported them. There's a good chance that she helped to restore Iona. I walked to Santiago de Compostela many years ago, in 1983, with one of my Dominican brethren, Alan White. And every church we went into on the route, we sang together the Salve Regina in 13th century Gregorian chant. And I think I might feel it coming on me in here.
I can hum along.
They might throw us out.
Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae.
Mairead, this is Palm Sunday.
Yeah.
And I know that you have done a lot of deep thinking about death and resurrection.
Yes. My mother died in mid-January, and her death was quite a slow process. One thing that occurred to me is traditional knowledge of dealing with death. Two generations ago, women my age would have been well used to dealing with the dying. I was completely unprepared for the process of dying and thinking about dying. And I think that comes into how we deal with Easter week. Because for a lot of us, if we think of Easter week as about the death, but not the resurrection, then it's hopeless. It's very dark. It's very hard to take.
And it's, I think, a huge miss when we skip from Palm Sunday and we focus on the triumphal entry and the palm branches waving and then rock up the next Sunday and yeah. celebrate Easter without going through that Holy Week
exactly.
journey and process.
It's so easy to do, and I think it's symptomatic of the society we live in today. And it's if we're unable to cope with death. And I think for many people, it would be so easy to miss that whole journey in between, which is the whole transformation process from one mm-hmm. to the other. And I think this is where the Easter process, thinking about Jesus's death as part of the transformation journey, is so important. On Palm Sunday, of course, there was a festival going on in the mm-hmm. city at that time, so it was highly symbolic that he chose that time to make the procession. I mean, he could have come on a grand stallion, or he could have come in a, you know, with a procession of the apostles in front of him or behind him, but he didn't. He chose to come very humbly.
What do you think it means to be humble, Mary?
I think humility is misunderstood sometimes. It doesn't mean grovelling or shaming yourself or underestimating your capabilities, but it means being yourself and offering yourself as you are, no better, no worse than anyone else, but being at the service of others.
And I think understanding that you are completely interrelated.
Yeah.
And I'm part of this with you.
So that was sung every night here before they went to bed, before the great silence and went to bed. It was also often sung at the deathbed of the monks, the last sleep. So, powerful stuff. One of the lines in it is, after this exile is over, show us your womb's most blessed fruit, our Jesus. So it's a, you know, we are in exile. It's that, going back to that peregrinus motif. This is not our world. This is not where we ultimately belong. We're headed we're on pilgrimage, we're on the way, you know. So there's this echoing of that pilgrim detachment, I suppose, and freedom that comes with it as well. You know, you're not tied down by this, the powers of this world, you know.
And actually, you can be so much more present where you are if you're on pilgrimage.
You're not tied to it.
You're not tied.
Christ, you roll down through riotous cheers and menacing, uneasy whispers. You roll down toward a place no one could imagine. And you asked those who loved you to follow. And Christ, that is frightening. Because all these centuries later, you ask the same thing. Stay with me. Follow me.
But all too often we have a sit-down strike in the middle of your moving day. Instead of staying with you, we choose to stick to what's safe and familiar. During this most holy week, help us to change direction. Help us to take up our lives and follow you.
So, Sally, what do you think of this, where we're stood at the moment?
All day we've been moving from one beautiful place to another beautiful place, and now we've hit the end of the day and the sun's beginning to set, and we're in Loch Leven.
Yeah, well, not actually in the loch yet, but getting close to it. We're stood at the side of this wonderful, freshly ploughed, brown, loamy field. And behind us in Loch Leven, there's a little island, St. Cerf's Island, in the middle of the loch, which is where the same St. Cerf who founded a monastery in Cúras that we were speaking about earlier, he who flung his bachel across the Forth, that same St. Cerf is credited with founding a monastery on this little island as well. And it's also, of course, ideally placed for the pilgrims. They came north from Dunfermline across the farmlands. Close to here, we're quite close to a good crossing point of the River Leven. And we're now on the west shore of Loch Leven, the west bank. We've just been to it, in fact, a little place called Port Moke, where there was a church which was an ecclesia hospitalis, a church which had a lodging place for pilgrims and perhaps for poor people, for the sick and so on. But it's one of a network of places with hospitales, or spittles as they call them in Scotland, places of hospitality of that sort. So we are still in this monastic pilgrimage landscape.
The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by, and that has made all the difference.
So what'll it be? Choose. The wielding of power that hurts people and our planet. The impulse to consume that robs the powerless. Today's embodiments of Pilate daring anyone to object. Or a collection of vulnerable but determined followers of justice and peace. Whose hope will we throw our weight behind? Whose path will we follow? Which road do we take? Robert Frost calls this poem tricky and warns readers not to fall into his trap. He wrote The Road Not Taken for one of his regular walking companions, a friend who always struggled to decide which path to take. Whenever they approached a crossroads or a fork in their road, he would haver and hesitate, agonize over the decision, until they arbitrarily ambled on. For the rest of the walk, he was wistful and worried. Where would the other road have taken them? He was so preoccupied with what they might be missing that he missed the gift that unfolded at his feet. Frost found this behavior bemusing and so very human. Invariably, there will be variables. There will always be paths not taken, people not met, adventures not had, joys that slip by like quicksilver. All bittersweet, but perhaps part of the beauty. It made me think that maybe how we choose to travel the road, what we carry with us, what informs our steps, is as important as which road we take. This Palm Sunday, as we step into Holy Week, we see that our life is a sacred pilgrimage, with paths that offer us holy places for personal reflection and public proclamation of our intent to stay with Jesus. When the sky darkens like an angry, sulky mood, after the palm branches dry up and blow away, as the worshipful shouts of Hosanna turn towards wayward whispers, we will carry his forgiving peace, his love, his incessant support for the most vulnerable with us wherever we journey. We will choose his way in how we spend our money, our energy, our time, our love. The question Palm Sunday always asks, can you, will you stay with him? So what'll it be?
Christ, you keep asking us to go the extra mile, to walk with others, share our provisions, veer off and visit the prisoner, or feed the hungry, or carry your cross. But all too often we give up halfway. We run away or amble slowly or do an impressive sidestep. During this most holy time, help us to keep trudging on, dancing or limping.
Christ, as you ride on through the riotous cheers and the menacing, uneasy whispers, as you ride on toward a place we struggle to imagine, help us to stay. Help us to follow, for we are the body that has come after you. We are the answer to your prayers. Idle watchers would call that foolish. Hesitant waverers would call that frightening.
We, with audacious hope, call that a blessing. Amen.
A blessing as we step into Holy Week. Blessings as you walk, as you work, when you're weary, when you wonder. Blessings when you stop, to wait for a friend, to pray for your enemy, to respond rather than react, to listen to the Spirit song all around you. Blessings when you stay with those who are frightened, forgotten, forever pushed to the margins. You will find Jesus waiting for you there.
Sunday Worship was presented by Sally Foster Fulton with Gilbert Marcus and Mairead Nicra. The producer was Mo McCulloch. Next week, Sunday Worship celebrates Easter Day from Canterbury Cathedral. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the Most Reverend and Right Honourable Sarah Mullally, will be the preacher at this live service, which will feature music from her installation and Matthew King's Canterbury Missa Brevis, a new mass specially composed for the service that Sunday Worship next week at the same time. And Sarah Mullally, who was installed as the new Archbishop of Canterbury just days ago, will be the topic of today's profile. It's at 15:15. In a moment, we go back into history and the breaking of the sound barrier.
Bold, silly, daring, unpredictable.
Celebrating Stop Art on BBC Radio 4.
My mind was made up.
I see your point.
It seemed the easiest thing to do.
Well then, don't procrastinate.
Drama from across the career of the playwright Sir Tom Stoppard.
Everything's upside down in the camp. It's as if you're either mad or the world is.
Alongside documentaries with insight from those who knew him.
One of the most experimental, innovative playwrights.
He needed the audience to complete that experience.
Celebrating Stoppard, next Saturday, Sunday and Monday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, history told by the people who are there. It's Witness History with Rachel Naylor.
This airplane and this pilot are about to be the first ever to fly faster than the speed of sound in level flight.
It's 1947 and we're in the Mojave Desert in California in the US. 24-year-old fighter pilot Chuck Yeager has been selected for a government program hoping to launch the first ever supersonic flight. It will involve flying a Bell X-1, an orange single-seated rocket-powered plane, nicknamed Glamorous Glennis after Chuck's wife. But two nights before the flight, he'd been to the Happy Bottom Riding Club, a popular hangout for test pilots run by the legendary aviator Florence Pancho Barnes. And on the morning of the 14th of October, as Chuck told the BBC in 1986, he's not feeling too good. In fact, he's feeling
rotten. My wife and I have been out to a dinner party a couple of nights before, and we were riding horses, racing, and somebody closed the gate to the corral when we were coming back. It was about midnight, and I couldn't drive the horse as well as I could drive airplanes, so I took the thing through the gate, and it tumbled, and I ended up with a couple of broken ribs, but that's the way it goes.
But Chuck, speaking on the BBC's Battle of the Rocket Man, made by IWC Media in 2005, wasn't going to let a couple of broken ribs stand in his way. He went straight to the vets.
Next day was Monday. I went to a veterinarian, and veterinarian said, you got two broken ribs on the right side. He taped me up, and I went back to base on Monday and got a hold really and said, I got a problem. He explained it to him, and we got in the X-1. I couldn't close the door because the door came against the right side. You got a lever. You got to raise it all the way up. I couldn't do it with my right hand. This lever, it was down here, had a couple bars on it and really got a 10-inch broomstick, sawed off, so stick it between the bars and close it with your left hand. Worked beautifully.
It was a $1 solution for a problem with a $1 million plane, thanks to Jack Ridley, Chuck's flight engineer. Chuck, armed with his broom handle and his ribs taped up, arrived at Muroc Field, a remote Air Force base chosen for its proximity to Rogers Dry Lake, effectively a 70-square-kilometre landing strip. At 10 a.m., he took off in a Boeing B-29 aircraft carrier, which was carrying the X-1 in its bomb bay. He didn't take off in the X-1 because
it consumed so much fuel so fast that you could take off on the ground, but you would burn up your fuel before you get up to altitude to do the work. So they drop you from a B-29 to give you a head start on it.
At 1,500 metres, Chuck got into position.
You slide into the cockpit, feet first, and then old Jack Ridley, my flight engineer, would come down with the door and hold it against the side of the airplane. We'd lock it on the inside.
Captain Yeager gets aboard the XS-1. It can't be a long flight he's going to have in the little aircraft. At full power, the flight can't last more than 2.5 minutes. But it's going to be a fast one.
Without Chuck's careful handling, the X-1's rocket engine would either propel the aircraft into history or explode. In effect, he was piloting a flying bomb.
Well, that's kind of wild sounding, but it wasn't quite that bad.
Oh, come on, Chuck. You were travelling at speeds of more than 1,000 kilometres per hour while sitting on 4 tons of fuel.
When you live and breathe that sort of thing, that's the way it is. You know, that's your job, and you're trained for that sort of thing.
Yes.
And then you fire off the rockets and accelerate out. And we ran into a lot of heavy buffeting. And my feeling was that, you know that the X-1 wouldn't bite me without giving me some sort of warning. And I'd already had the thing up to about 95% of the speed of sound. We were in heavy buffeting, and I just looked at it as a job and pressed on.
For Chuck, pressing on meant attempting to reach speeds faster than Mach 1, the speed of sound. Over the previous 2 months, he'd been training in the X-1, flying faster and faster. But it wasn't without incident. But on his 8th flight, as he reached Mach 0.94, Chuck lost control of the plane. He came back down and told Jack that his elevators, the hinged flaps which control the plane's pitch, had stopped working. Unperturbed, Jack turned the whole horizontal tail into one large adjustable stabilizer to help Chuck regain control at high speed.
It was a surprise to all of us. That stabilizer, you know, we had never used it before. We squirted a lot of oil on, got to run up and down and checked it out. And he said, "Won't you go up and fly the airplane with the horizontal stabilizer?" And I did on the next flight. I didn't take it to 9.4 to try it. I tried it at about 9.2. And it was very effective. And then I took it up to 9.4. We'd lost the elevator effectiveness. Tried it. It was extremely effective.
On the morning of the 14th of October, the plan was to reach Mach 0.97. At 10:26 a.m., at an altitude of 6,000 metres, Chuck and the X-1 were released from the aircraft carrier at a speed of 400 kilometres per hour.
There she goes. A big moment in a history-making flight.
I was sitting there watching the Mach meter, which tells me what my speed is in relationship to the speed of sound, and the thing fluctuated at about 9.6 and went off the scale. When it did, you know, all the buffeting quit because we had supersonic flow.
Now she's approaching the barrier.
At 13,000 metres, Chuck reached Mach 1.06, a speed of more than 1,100 kilometres per hour.
The really big moment. Through the sound barrier. The first time ever in level flight.
And Chuck was the only one who didn't hear that.
You're in the cockpit and you don't hear sonic booms when you fly at supersonic speed. That's only because a shock wave is forming on the airplane and that shock wave travels to the ground. That's what you hear is a concussion wave.
Many aviators had believed it was not possible to fly faster than the speed of sound, believing drag would tear any aircraft apart. But Chuck and the X-1 had done it.
To go back a little bit, you got to remember, this is 1947, and although we ran into buffeting and the effects of the speed of sound on our Mustangs and 109s and 190s when we were dogfighting over Germany, we'd never been able to fly an airplane into the region of the speed of sound. The X-1 was designed specifically for that.
The concept of a sound barrier crumbled into myth.
I felt good about it.
Terrific.
That's what we were wanting to do, and it opened up a whole new era.
But due to national security, his record was kept secret for months. Chuck belatedly became a national hero.
In October 1947, at Murat Desert Test Center in California, history is made by this aircraft, the XS-1, and its pilot, Captain Charles E. Yeager.
After that, flight technology kept advancing. 5 years later, Chuck's rival, Scott Crossfield, became the first to fly at twice the speed of sound, Mach 2. But not to be outdone, a month later, Chuck reclaimed his title as the fastest pilot and reached Mach 2.44, a speed of 2,700 kilometres per hour. But the attempt didn't totally go to plan. At Mach 2.3, he lost control of the plane and dropped 16,000 metres in less than a minute. But somehow, Chuck managed to land safely.
1,650 miles per hour, 2.5 times the speed of sound. The X-1A records a new chapter in aviation history. Its pilot, Major Yeager, is recognized as the world's fastest human.
Brigadier General Chuck Yeager retired from the US Air Force in 1975. He died in 2020, age 97.
They say
The saying goes, anyway, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no such thing as old, bold pilots. I presume you would challenge that.
Well, there's a few of us around. Not too many. It's a matter of luck, actually.
Is it luck?
Well, that and getting a lot of experience. You have to look back. There's no such thing as a natural-born pilot. And even when I was a 20-year-old fighter pilot up in East Angeles, flying out of there in 43, 44, and 45, I was becoming very, very experienced from combat, and that helped in my research flying later on.
But you can only get the experience if you've got a lot of luck.
Well, you have to live, and as I mentioned, you know, a lot of times never get yourself into a position where a pathologist has to identify you.
Or indeed examine you in any way. Yeah. Terrific stuff. Riveting. Yeah. General Yeager, a great hero. Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You.
Witness History was presented by Rachel Naylor, and for more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. We'll join Paddy O'Connell for Broadcasting House at 9 o'clock, and Cy King, broadcaster and cook, best known as one half of the duo The Hairy Bikers, today shares the soundtrack of his life with Lauren Levan. That's on Desert Island Discs at 10 o'clock. It's the Siskin for today's Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton, chosen by Springwatch ornithologist Jack Baddams.
March is siskin season in my neck of the woods. I'm a bird ringer, meaning I'm licensed under the British Trust for Ornithology to put ID rings on wild birds to help us understand more about their lives. One of my favourite birds I've ever had the pleasure to meet whilst ringing is a female siskin, who made a star appearance at a demonstration where the public had come along to watch. The crowd cooed over this beautiful little finch with her citrus greens, yellows and delicate streaking. But then she became even more amazing when we noticed she was already wearing a ring. On closer inspection, it bore the mark of Swedish origin. We get an influx of siskins into the UK in winter, sometimes in huge numbers. In 2024, a surge in siskins was seen across the country. Ringers were out monitoring them, and we know that birds arriving here had rings from Scandinavia, the Czech Republic, and as far away as the Russian Arctic Circle. And then they disappear. Most return back across the sea, others melt into our big pine forests. Even if you live in an area where siskins nest,